We do not have a quorum quite yet, but we got most of the people are going to show up today are here, and Representative Grunhagen has been here waiting for us, and so we will start out with his presentation.
Okay. If I could just have the page come over. She's just bringing my things. Hand out one of these for each person. There's enough for some of the people in the audience. Yep. Hey, thank you, Chairman Huntley, for giving me this chance just to highlight what I consider to be a concern about the exchange as far as the subsidy is concerned. And what I'm looking for is maybe we can come to a bipartisan solution on how to address this concern if members of the committee find that they also see it as a problem. I have the page giving you a handout. I'll just wait till that's handed out to the members of the committee. Everybody's got that?
Yep.
Okay.
Most important.
Okay, well, I'll start. We had testimony in the HHS Policy Committee by an attorney by the name of Ronald Seeloff. He highlighted certain concerns about the exchange and the subsidy that's available in there. What I did, I simply took an example from his handout that I have a copy of, and other people can have a copy to have a complete referral of it. But when you look at this, this is off the Kaiser Health Reform, and this is actually how your subsidies will be figured. And what the example shows is, for $80,000, this would be a married couple, family of four, they would receive, if you look at the right-hand side, if they have a premium of $12,130, they would receive about a $4,530 government tax credit towards the purchase of their health insurance at an $80,000 income level for a family of four. Now, if you flip the page over on the back side, you'll see if their income went up during the year, if they worked hard and actually got a raise and got ahead in life, they then lose their, to $94,000, they then lose their tax credit. Okay? So the result is, the way it's set up, you're actually penalized for earning additional money with your tax credit. And this is true at a number of different levels. In fact, if you look how the tax credit is developed, this couple would be better off getting divorced and putting income into the maximum amount of income into one person's name, and that way they could actually maximize their government tax credit. Now, there's been articles about this this problem in the New York Times, the Washington Times, and in a number of other national newspapers. I've got copies of those articles if you'd like, but I didn't want to blitz you with too much paper. But here's one analysis that was done on the tax credit. If you have a married couple earning $60,000 a year, and their combined premium is $12,000, they would receive about a $1,300. Just a minute, I got that backwards. Let's put it this way. If they were married versus if they just lived together, they could gain an additional $10,680 of tax credit from the government. So by living together versus married, if they each earn $30,000, the married couple would lose up to $10,680 on the government tax credit. So you basically, let's say two people wanted to get married, they each had health insurance, and they each were earning $30,000, all of a sudden they were getting a credit on the exchange, all of a sudden they found out when they got married they would lose up to $10,680 on their credit towards the purchase of insurance. So they'd probably look at each other and say, well, why should we get married? Okay? And we're better off living together and getting the credit for our health insurance. At the $80,000 level, it's a difference of from being, you know, where they each earn $40,000. If they get married, they have a combined income of $80,000, they would lose about a $9,120 subsidy from the government towards the purchase of their health insurance. So what I see here is that we actually penalize marriage and we penalize working hard and earning more money. So the harder you work, the less, you know, the less credit you get. So there's almost an incentive not to work hard and to not get married. Okay? And on top of that, if they work hard, then there's a possibility of having a clawback feature on their credit where they'll actually have to pay back to the IRS the credit they received because they got additional income. Okay. Now, here's why I believe this is an important point, and I've attached several studies and just examples of them. Marriage is the greatest weapon against child poverty. In other words, we know in order to lift children out of poverty.
Point of order, Chair. Chair.
Sure.
Representative.
I don't know if this is really germane to the health exchange. We're talking about the health exchange, and this does not seem to be a discussion that's pertinent to the health exchange bill that we've got in front of us right now.
I told Representative Grunhagen that he could have 15 minutes this morning, so I'm going to allow him to. But I agree with you. I don't think this relates to the exchange, which is the bill we're dealing with.
Well, the exchange deals with the tax credit for the purchase of the health insurance, so it's hard for me to understand how this doesn't apply. But
go ahead.
We can agree to disagree on that. Okay, so basically, and I'm just about wrapped up here, this marriage, if we look... turn the page, you'll see a graph, the death of marriage in the United States, and it shows how since the 60s marriage has declined precipitously to the detriment of our children. And the interesting thing, it coordinates with the Great Society programs that were started in the 60s. The interesting thing, if you look at the statistics, out-of-wedlock births in our country were at about 7% prior to the great welfare programs of the 60s. Today, they're at 33%. In terms of black families, the out-of-wedlock birth in the 60s was about under 20%, about 17%. Today in the inner city, it's over 80%. So what I'm trying to illustrate is we know that the breakdown of the family has had tremendous social cost. And what I'm trying to illustrate is that government programs in the past have actually undermined the family, created a breakdown of the family and single parents, and the result is it's hard to print up enough money to take care of all the problems that come out of that. So we're basically taking the great society programs of the 60s, which have contributed to the breakdown of the family and single parents, and we're now moving that into the middle class to do the same type of a thing with the exchange and the subsidy that's in there. That's my concern. I did share this already with Representative Atkins. He was also concerned about it. He has a copy of this packet from Attorney Seeloff. I also have an example of how Minnesota's marriage rate has declined, and there's a direct connection between child poverty and the decline in marriage. And finally, the last page, if you want to address the achievement gap, which is costing us hundreds of millions of dollars in this state, one of the best ways to do it is to develop government programs that actually reinforce the family rather than undermine the family. That's my concern, is we're taking this same philosophy that has, you know, basically destroyed the black family in our inner cities, and we now are going to move it into the middle class of the people of the state of Minnesota and across this nation. Thank you for that opportunity to present.
Any questions for Representative Grunhag? Okay, I don't say anything, and I will say that coming from a science background, there's a difference between cause and correlation.
I understand.
And the best example I ever heard of that is that if you look at the incidence of diabetes in the population, it's a and versus miles driven in a car by that population, it's a perfectly straight line, 0.99%, and obviously there's no cause caused by the miles driven in a car per year for diabetes. I will also say that you can find the same thing, Representative Grunhagen. Seniors, by and large, would be economically advantaged if they got divorced. Because then if one of the seniors ended up in a nursing home, the other one wouldn't have to pay for it.
Mr. Chair, I would agree with you. There again, we have a financial incentive to get divorced, and I've seen that with my own aunt who had got remarried and then had to go in the nursing home. They got divorced in order to save their asset. So you simply make my point. So many of the government programs actually provide an incentive to divorce and not marry, versus reinforcing the traditional marriage. And it's the breakdown of the family that has created tremendous cultural cost and devastation to our children in this society. And and simply one last comment.
Yep.
When a government undermines the traditional family, all right, you cannot print up enough money to take care of all the problems that come out of it.
Okay, we have a quorum, so I'll call the meeting to order, and Representative Liebling is on the list for a question or comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just going to say, you know, I appreciate that you're giving Representative Grunhagen time to discuss something that's not related to the bill. But I came in today to hear about the bill, and I am have plenty of other work to do. And so if Representative Grunhagen wants to continue this line, I would appreciate it if you could, or if he could let us know when, how much time he's getting so that I can do something else in the meantime, and then I'll come back and be here to listen to the bill. Thank you.
Representative Liebling, we're going to move on right now after we have one more question, comment, to presentations of the fiscal note. Representative Fisher.
I'll pass at this point in time. I think Representative Liebling hit what I wanted to talk about.
Okay,
Mr. Chair.
Yeah, Representative Dean.
Mr. Chair, if I understand correctly, Representative Grunhagen had some issues that he wanted to present regarding the cost of this particular bill and a potential marriage penalty that would be a direct cost to all of our taxpayers if this were to be passed. He brought this up yesterday. He respectfully asked for some time to pursue this. He was told that he could not discuss this yesterday, and that he could bring it up this morning. I see that there's barely a quorum here, that we are about 14 minutes in, and I think we've had three comments questioning Representative Gruenhagen's right to look at the fiscal note, look at this bill, and look at the effects on his taxpayers in his district. I don't think that it's necessarily appropriate to criticize him, being that he not only asked for permission for this, but was told he couldn't do it yesterday, came back today, and very, very briefly covered this. I think it's disrespectful to Representative Gruenhagen to treat it in any, to mock him or his right as a legislator to pursue the fiscal note, pursue the bill in a way that I think is entirely appropriate.
Okay. Representative Fisher, you wanted to comment?
Yeah, I just want to say I have no problem discussing and looking at the fiscal note. I think that's very appropriate. What I do think, though, is when we start going into the areas of what marriage is and defining love and who has the rights to marriage and getting into the racial components of it, I think we're now then starting to go into a whole another area where I don't think we belong in at this point in time. I think what we should be focusing is on, you know, if we've got some fiscal concerns, let's focus on the fiscal concerns we have there and not drift off into other areas. And that's all I want to make sure that we understand. Thank you.
Mr. Berg, do you want to make a presentation of the fiscal note, or are we going to have staff from...
Mr. Chair, I could run over the summary page if you like. I think the questions in detail are probably better addressed by the exchange staff.
Okay, so why don't you run through it first?
Okay. Mr. Chair and members, I think you all have in your packet a fiscal note that is titled Consolidated Fiscal Note, 13-14 Session, House File 5, Second Engrossment. I just note that the bill has been amended several times. This is the last version of it, and it will get renewed again probably after Monday if this committee votes it out. Just looking at the summary fiscal page, you see at the top are net expenditures. For this committee's interest, I'd note there's one general fund reference on here, and it's at the Human Services Department. You see at the top there are costs in 14 through 17 that are related to the state share of medical assistance allocable costs. And I should note that those costs will not be appropriated through this bill or through the exchange. The state share of Medicare allocable costs will end up getting picked up by the Human Services Finance Committee that has general fund appropriations to medical assistance in its purview. So they're noted here so that people can see that that's the state portion of those costs. You probably all know that the exchange will also serve as the state's enrollment and eligibility tool for medical assistance. And that's why a portion of the exchange's activities can be allocated to the Medicare program, and as such, the state pays a share of that, which will happen in this committee. Going down from there, you see the main revenue from the premium withhold is listed there under miscellaneous special revenue, and there are special revenue items listed for costs at the Health Department, the Commerce Department, and the Department of Administration related to their statutory duties in insurance regulation and getting the exchange going. If you move to the, or that's the net, excuse me, I said revenue, but I meant expenditure section. If you move to the revenue section, you see there is a small amount of general fund revenue at the Department of Commerce, which is relative to more policy and rate filings that will happen out of this. The bulk of the revenue from the assessment is there. I misspoke before, and it's actually in this middle section. The miscellaneous special revenue and listed under health insurance is the bulk of the premium withhold. And then below that, numbers matching the expenditure numbers for Health Department, Commerce Department, and Department of Administration. The bill allows the health exchange through interagency agreements to pay the statutory costs that the other departments will incur, and those match each other if you see the expenditures and revenues.
Mr. Berg, on the revenue, does that include in the first year the federal government is paying 100% of the cost of operating the exchange?
Mr. Chair, the federal revenue is not reflected on the spreadsheet, but when you get down to the cost section, the net cost sections, you'll see that in fiscal 13 there is no net, there's zeros, and then moving over to 14 you have at the cost, it's negative numbers, which indicate a savings on a fiscal note. It really indicates the balance of the assessment piling up there for future use. But the federal funds are not listed on this sheet. That section at the bottom, net costs and savings to the state, really are a summary of the two upper sections. They show, again, the general fund portion of the costs that this committee will have to deal with, a slight amount of revenue to the general fund from the Commerce Department's fee structure, and then the health exchange having, in the case of negatives, surplus, that's extra revenue, revenue that's not spent, that is in their bottom line. And in one case, you get to the fiscal 16 where you see that there are going to be expenditures in excess of revenues. I think Ms. Julek will probably explain later, there are some cost scenarios at the end of their section that indicate different scenarios for what the exchange will cost under different enrollment situations. And the bottom of that just shows the estimate for full-time equivalent staffing for the exchange by department. I should note that the numbers on this summary page reflect the high enrollment scenario for both revenues and expenditures. And as I say, there are more than one scenario, but this reflects the high enrollment scenario on the summary page. Mr. Chair, there are individual sections for both DHS and the Health Department that are relative to this committee, but I don't know if it is valuable to go over those. They largely repeat what I just said about the Medicaid allocable costs at DHS and the general fund that this committee will deal with, and costs at the health department relative to their duties and certifying health plans, which will be covered through the exchange. And Mr. Chair, unless there are any questions, that's all I would say about the fiscal note.
Any questions for Mr. Berg? Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a brief question of clarification. Mr. Berg, you referenced under revenues, under the line health insurance exchange, that those numbers, fiscal year 14, it looks like it'd be 21,927,000 going up to 48,52,62. You said, is that coming from the withhold? Is that what, that's where those numbers are coming from?
Mr. Chair, Representative Mack, that's correct. The revenue situation here in the middle is all coming from the premium withhold, with the exception of the $25,000 a year in general fund fees that are generated by the Commerce Department by additional filings and rate filings that will happen. But otherwise, that revenue section is all covered by the result of the premium withhold.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Other questions? Representative Dean.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was just wondering, I was looking at the front of the fiscal note, and it's dated 2-6-13, and we've had several changes to that. Do we have an updated fiscal note after minus 2-6? So I think it's the 15th today. Is there something?
Mr. Chair, representatives, this is the most updated fiscal note. There's been some discussion between myself and the staff at the Minnesota Management and Budget about when the best times to renew the fiscal note were, and we had agreed between us that the amendments that had gone on prior to this committee were not so large that they justified another iteration of the fiscal note, and we were planning to renew it probably after this committee passes it on Monday, is the current staff thinking on the next iteration of it. But maybe the exchange staff can comment if they see that amendments have gone on that have substantial fiscal impact. I don't think any of them that have gone on have a major impact at this point, and that's why we thought it was not useful of people's time to renew the fiscal note until after this committee was done.
Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, just, you know, I'm on page 10 and 11 of the fiscal note, and I just, you know, these look like salaries for positions in the exchange, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, that's correct. There's a series of tables that lay out by employment function the estimated staffing and salaries of the exchange.
Mr. Chair, so what percent of the operating costs are salary and benefits? Do you have an estimate of the $60 million?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen,
if you don't have it, you can
I do not off the top of my head. I don't know if the exchange staff have that. I'm sure we could do that.
You can check for it. That's okay. I just thought if you knew off the top.
We're going to have a...
I don't off the top of my head.
Julie will be up next.
Okay. Mr. Chair, just one follow-up comment. You know, I just tell committee or ask committee members and those in the audience and the author to look at all of these costs for salaries, and obviously there'll be benefits and all kinds of other things. And just ask yourself, how is this helping the doctor-patient relationship? How is draining hundreds of millions of dollars into government bureaucracy going to lower premiums, help the doctor-patient relationship, and create better healthcare outcomes going forward? Just think about that question, okay?
Well, Mr. Representative Grunhagen, 35,000 people that do not have a doctor-patient relationship will get one because of this bill.
And we can solve that without this.
All right, Mr. Byrd.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen, just on a very quick look at fiscal 15, on if you look on page 18, 17, 18, and 19, there are cost scenarios for the thing, exchange, excuse me. The just looking very quickly at 15, you've got $4.6 million in personnel costs. That's 16% of the total costs of the exchange in 15. It would be less of the net cost, and I actually don't know on MA allocation whether I should... Yeah, it's 16% of the total cost. It would be, I didn't figure the outer years, but anyway, that's where it is in the first year of the high enrollment scenario.
Okay, thank you.
I have to apologize. The 35,000 figure that I used is incorrect. That's based on the bill that the Senate just passed yesterday on the Medicaid expansion. The number of people that will get a doctor-patient relations don't have it today because of this bill is about 300,000. Nick, any other questions for Mr. Byrd? Seeing none, with Ms. Julek, if you would want to come up and talk about the fiscal impacts of the exchange bill.
Mr. Chair, members, my name is Barb Julek, and I'm the Finance Director for the Exchange. If I could just make one clarifying comment on the front sheet under the revenues, the $21 million and the $48 million also include reimbursements from the Medicaid program, which run between $8 and $9 million a year. So the revenues from the withhold would be the amounts listed here less that $8 to $9 million. And then, Mr. Chair, I think the best way to walk through this would be starting on the tables from page 18 and 19, and then which display the categories of costs, and then we can refer back to the tables and how those categories were how those numbers for those categories were produced. And again, as Mr. Berg mentioned, this fiscal note does lay out various enrollment scenarios which would impact the cost. The enrollment scenarios were based on the 2016 enrollment projections by Dr. Gruber, and then a budget model was used from the Wakely Consulting Group to estimate how that enrollment would phase up in calendar year 14, 15, and 16 to get to those final estimates for calendar year 16 from the Gruber estimates. And so you see three tables, and I'm sorry, the page is kind of run funny, but on page 17 starts the first summary table, which is based on the high enrollment scenario. And then table 28 is the medium enrollment, and table 29 is a low enrollment. And for the most part, they're all structured the same. The biggest difference between each table would be on the customer service activities that would vary based on enrollment participation. And then you'd see at the top of each table is an estimated withhold percent that would be applied to meet the annual cost of the exchange within each of those years. And so you'll see each table starts with a 3.5% withhold because that's written into the bill. But the subsequent years would vary dependent on the projected expenditures. And so the fiscal note assumes a lower withhold for each of the subsequent years based on the projected expenditures within that table. So the first line of the table, looking at the high enrollment scenario on page 18, rolls over. The first line is personnel costs. And as was mentioned, there's a series of tables starting on page 9, running through page 11 with the various positions that are estimated to be needed. These positions reflect what has been submitted to the federal government in our grant submissions as how we would staff the exchange. So there's no difference in these positions than what had been submitted in the grant applications and reviewed by the feds. And so that is what is reflected in these positions. And then as noted, there is a not only salaries, but the fringe benefit costs are calculated into these numbers. The next category is support costs, reflected on table 12. These are just calculations based on standards for, you know, annual costs for supplies, for communications, for you know, your Windows licensing, things like that, that are included in here. There's rent costs, some training costs in there. So those are included, and they're around $800,000 per year. The next cost item listed on the tables, consulting and contracting costs, that's on table 14 on page 13. We will need a contract to implement our quality rating system, and that is estimated here at $350,000. We'll have some ongoing training that we'll need to have. The grant money includes the federal grant dollars, which are not reflected in this fiscal note, includes a significant amount of initial training that would occur over the next 6 to 9 months. This number reflects more of an annual ongoing training budget. We'd have marketing and outreach, some communication materials that we develop every year. And at this point, this fiscal note included funding for the external auditor. I think there's been some discussion and testimony about how that would be paid for. Would it be a direct line item, or would it come out of an indirect expense? And so this line actually will probably come off, because my understanding from Director Nobles is that they have they're paid directly and through a statewide indirect cost, and so that would be reflected differently in the future fiscal note.
Yeah, I just want to point out to the members, I get a little confused here myself on table 12. I'm used to thinking there's three extra zeros behind those numbers. In this case, there are no three extra zeros behind those numbers.
Correct. Thousands. The next cost item on the table is the IT infrastructure cost, and details behind that are found on page 12. Two basic buckets here. The first is the IT infrastructure cost of $6.9 million. This is based on annual license and maintenance agreements renewals. We have a list, a number of items that we've been purchasing through the federal grant to set up the IT infrastructure. It's your hardware, your software, your operating licenses, and things like that. They will have annual maintenance and renewal agreements that need to be put in place, and they're traditionally between 25 and 30% of costs, and so that is what is reflected here. The second item is the actual marketplace tool. This is development of the eligibility determination system, the enrollment system, what's all being built into the website that will determine enrollment or eligibility enrollment, give you the provider comparison displays and such. And again, this would be the annual license renewal for that system is reflected here. The next item is where you get to the variable cost. This is the customer service area. And this is really where the high, medium, and low scenarios come into play. As mentioned earlier, the enrollment was based on the Gruber. The 2016 enrollment from Dr. Gruber was utilized in a model that then kind of back projected what 14 and 15 were. That model also projects what a per member per month cost would be for certain customer service activities like a call center, sending notices, doing the appeals process, premium collections and processing, eligibility assistance, other types of assistance, in-person and navigator assistance. And so based on that Wakely model, per member per month cost was calculated against the enrollment projections. And the result of that calculation is shown beginning in Table 15, which shows the per member per month calculations from the model, how that calculates per year and per calendar year, I should say. And then Table 16, 17, and 18 reflect various enrollment scenarios, the high, medium, and low, and how it those costs would fall out in a state fiscal year. And so those state fiscal year costs are then brought over to the summary tables for each of the scenarios. The next item on the summary table are other agency costs, and I cannot speak to the specifics of those costs, but they are reflected on Table 26, which is on page 17, and do include the Department of Commerce, the Department of Administration, and the Department of Health. And so the costs from their fiscal notes are brought into our fiscal note as a cost, as we would reimburse them for their activity. This agency obviously would have to pay a statewide indirect, and so that's a straight calculation there. And then the final area is Medicaid allocation, and the fiscal note starts on page 16 with that. And we would be proposing to allocate allowable activities to the Medicaid program based on eligibility participation ratio. So what percent of the enrollment is Medicaid versus overall participation. And under the grants, we were using projected. What we submitted to the federal government was at the time, the April 2012 projections from Dr. Gruber of that ratio. And that's what was in the grants. But moving forward, we would update to actual. And so now for the balance of the fiscal note, we would be utilizing the updated participation estimates. But as we operate, it would actually be based on actual ratios. And so what you see in Table 23 are what those two, what the April projection calculated, and then what the January projection would calculate out to. And those participation ratios are applied to various activities within the exchange, such as is it for eligibility, is it for enrollment, is it if it's for shop, if it's for small business, obviously there is no allocation to Medicaid. So again, using those eligibility ratios applied against eligible Medicaid activities, the results of that calculation is shown on Table 25. And again, there's a high, medium, and low scenario because under different enrollment scenarios, the Medicaid ratio is different, but it calculates anywhere in the high scenario to from 7 to 9 million, and in the low scenario from 7 to almost 12 million. And so those numbers are brought forward to the summary tables as well. And then you have a total cost each year. And again, from that total cost, the Medicaid amount is taken from there to get a net cost after Medicaid. And so in the high scenario, that's 19.3 million in fiscal 15, 48 in 16, and 51 million in fiscal 17. And then an assumed withhold is calculated based on that need. And so in the high enrollment scenario, again, it was assumed we would need about a 1.75% withhold to meet those expenditures. And it's not an exact calculation to the expenditures, but it's, you know, plus or minus a certain amount that could be handled within the reserve that was calculated out of the 3.5%. For the withhold amounts, there are tables reflecting how that was calculated, and that's on page 15. Again, the budget model on table 19 projected participation using the group estimates for 2016, backed it down into 14, took a phase up assumption, a monthly phase in assumption to calculate how many members, how many member months were in each of those calendar years. And so that's what's reflected there is the number of months per calendar year divided up into 6 months time periods because we have to do state fiscal year versus calendar year. Calculated those member months against the composite premium, which was a weighted average between the individual and the small group markets, and then applied the percentages. So again, in calendar year 14, a 3.5% was calculated, and then 15 and 16, lower amount is used in the fiscal note because we, the way the expenditures projected, you would not need the full 3.5%. It would range somewhere between 1.75 and 2.5. And so then that calculation is brought to the table as well. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions on that? Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, I was just looking at Table 16, 17, and 18 on page 46. And again, this is my first, you know, kind of look at this, so you'll have to help me. But at what point does the exchange, and let's just use low participation, generate enough money with the, you know, the 3.5% or whatever it works out to be, generate enough money to cover the expenses of about $60 million a year, which I understand is ongoing expenses. Because when I just look at these tables, high, low, and medium, on this particular page, which is page 14, I don't see enough money coming in to cover the cost of the exchange, but there must be an add-on someplace else that I'm missing.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grunhagen.
Or Mr. Julie.
Going back to page 18, the summary tables.
Okay.
And again, focusing on maybe the high enrollment, there's a total cost in fiscal 17, which is the last column, of $60.9 million, of which approximately $9 million is Medicaid. And so the non-Medicaid portion is about $52 million. Under this particular scenario, with this particular enrollment, again, this is the high enrollment scenario, about 1.75% withhold would need to be generated, again, based on this particular cost scenario, which has a specific enrollment scenario. If you look at the low enrollment table, which is table 29, the customer service costs go down because there's lower enrollment. The total cost under that scenario is approximately $45 million, of which $11.5 million is Medicaid. The net revenue, the need to generate additional revenue is at $33.8 million. Mm-hmm. And under this scenario, that would be, again, this scenario with this enrollment projection would be a 2.5% withhold to generate that much revenue for that year. Is that answering your question?
That helps.
Okay. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am looking at page 9 of the fiscal note, and this is just one thing that I noticed, and looking for maybe guidance if there's other places where this exists, but as I look in section 6, subdivision 1, in that first paragraph, it's talking about the fact that the exchange is going to employ 86 FTEs once it's fully established. In the middle of that paragraph, it says that the costs are based on existing state classifications. Mm-hmm. And then it continues to go down. It says, under this bill, the board shall establish compensation structures for managerial staff for review by MMB and approved by the legislature. As such, salary levels for managerial staff are likely underestimated. Mm-hmm. And then the next paragraph, it explains that other states have, on average, 50% higher levels of those reflected in this fiscal note, and that this could end up costing up to $1 million more than what is reflected in this. And so I guess a couple questions. One, is there any way that in the next fiscal note the numbers could be run in such a way that would help give us a little bit more of an accurate picture of what those numbers might look like? And two, are there other places, I mean, or what else in this might be underestimated based on current law when we know that this bill, there's several parts of this bill that will not allow the exchange or will not have the exchange exist under current law, particularly under salaries. They'll have a whole other mechanism for how they're able to set and structure their salaries. That is kind of giving us a hard time to really understand what that fiscal impact is going to be.
Ms. Jewett.
Mr. Chair, Representative, for the first piece, if $1 million per year was added to the tables, and again, looking at the summary tables on page 18, you'd have an additional $1 million per year of cost. A portion of that would be allocated to Medicaid. I'd need to run the calculation, but a portion would be allocated to Medicaid, and some net would be needed to be covered by the withhold. So for the sake of an example, let's say it's $800,000. So you'd have to generate an additional $800,000 out of the withhold. That's going to probably be between 0.03 and 0.08% as a range that would need to be generated as an example. And the second part of the question, I'm not sure I quite understood.
Okay, sorry about that. I'll try to explain it. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess just what I'm asking, are there other areas in this fiscal note? And I was trying to look to see if I saw similar language. But due to the way that the bill is currently crafted, that would suggest that the way you're able to run the numbers under current law will not accurately reflect what the numbers will be once this language passes and the financing mechanisms or whatever they might be under the exchange would actually end up being higher or lower but aren't accurately reflected in this fiscal note just simply because it's based on current law and not what this language will be passing.
Ms. Julie.
Not that I'm aware of, but my lifelines are gone.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative.
Yeah, I understand it might be a bit of a detailed answer. So I guess if maybe we could follow up early sometime next week or follow up, and if you could just let me know if there's other areas, and I'll continue to look through. I think I have and haven't seen anything glaringly, but it would just be helpful to know because obviously that's a bit concerning, particularly when it comes to the fact that this bill is changing the way salaries are set, and it's not based on how current law is structured, which raises some concerns in other ways, but nonetheless, the fact that it makes a fiscal note hard to look at. So, thank you.
Ms. Julek, the money that we're charging to medical assistance, is that considered to be an additional expense to medical assistance, or we're already paying for that under other ways right now to enroll people? By the counties. How is that adjusted?
Mr. Chair, I think there's probably two answers to that, and I'll ask DHS to assist or correct me. The money reflected in the fiscal note is new money to Medicaid, and this is new money associated with costs to the system, allocating exchange costs for Medicaid allowable activities within there. Other Medicaid costs, such as at the county level, I think I'm out of my league on that one.
My point is, Dr. Golden, that we're already registering people under our current system for medical assistance. Determined. Somebody's paying for that out of our budget. Is that reflected in here, that some of that cost is going to go away?
Mr. Chair, committee members, for the record, Jim Golden, Deputy Assistant Commissioner at DHS. You know, there are a couple of things in the fiscal note. I think there are three basic types of costs, I think, as it relates to medical assistance. One is primarily the customer service. The vast majority of customer service associated with medical assistance is done at the county level through the counties. There is approximately $100 million worth of expenditures in the counties to help people get on to medical assistance and to do the case management associated with that. Approximately $50 million of that comes from the counties themselves as the state share, and the other $50 million is pulled down by DHS as federal participation. This doesn't anticipate that changing. The vast majority of the assistance to medical assistance will still flow through the counties, and that's represented at the end of the fiscal note in the local considerations. The second issue is there is a variety of activities that occur at DHS that we do today. So, for example, training, oversight of the counties, putting together materials for enrollees. To the degree that that's activity that we are doing today, I think we envision that the vast majority of that will continue. We'll simply be doing it in a streamlined, coordinated fashion with the exchange. And those portions that are attributed to us are cost allocated to us in that. That would be in our existing dollars. The third major expense that is associated with this is really the IT systems that are associated with this. And one of the things that we have been doing for a couple of years that was passed by the legislature is really updating our IT eligibility systems. There was funding that was provided to help streamline that a couple of years ago. And then in the governor's budget, there is also a systems modernization request that is there. And that activity is new dollars as we upgrade our IT systems.
Thank you. And we have a follow-up question from Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I forgot to just ask a follow-up in terms of a kind of an open-ended question in the fiscal note on page 6. In the second paragraph under participation, just another spot where it shows that assumptions weren't made within this fiscal note but mm-hmm. could have an impact if they were. Mm-hmm. The last sentence in that paragraph said, reductions to enrollment based on the risk assumptions outlined above for Section 4, Sub 2 are not included in the enrollment assumptions. And I guess my question is, if those were included in the enrollment assumptions, what impact would that have on the fiscal note?
Madam Chair, members, primarily two impacts. The likely scenario would probably fall to the low enrollment scenario, and the Medicaid share would be increased, or the Medicaid piece of the fiscal note would be reflective of that higher amount.
Okay. Next question is Representative Fisher.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not too sure who's going to be probably the best to answer this, but I'm going to start with table 19. So where I'm looking at is on the composite premium that I'm seeing. Am I to understand that is the estimate of what the premiums would be combined as an average in each of those scenarios?
Yeah.
Madam Chair, Representative, so the composite premium is based on a few things. First, we started with Dr. Gruber's estimate of what the 2016 average individual premiums would be without the ACA. And that was $3,900. And I'll apologize, there's a typo in the fiscal note. The $3,900 is the estimate in 2016 for what the premium would be without the ACA. And then there's a number of assumptions of how that would increase with the ACA, anywhere from 15 to 29%, depending on what happens with MSHA, what the risk pools are, and things like that. For the purpose of this fiscal note, I chose 23%, which reflects a three-year phase-out of MSHA, which I believe was the board's most recent recommendation. So that $3,900 was increased by 23% for calendar year 16. That amount then was backed down for 15 and 14 based on 5.5% annual growth, which has been the trend for the past number of years. And so a calendar year 14 and 15 estimated premium was calculated for individuals. On the small group side, the premium was based on 2009 inflated 5.1% until you get to 2014. So you had an individual premium estimate and a small group estimate. Then we took the enrollment projections from the model to create a weighted average, if you will, between the two, and that is what's reflected here.
Okay.
Mr. Fisher.
Thank you. I'll probably have a couple more follow-up questions as we go through this, so I've got a good understanding of it. Now, this premium we're seeing is the premium before there would be any offsets of subsidies or anything like that. That's correct?
That's okay. Correct, Mr. Chairman.
And then this premium that we're seeing here, does that also include the estimated 3.5% or 2.5% in the scenarios right below that, the withhold?
Ms. Jewett.
The premium is reflective of Dr. Gruber's estimate for 2016.
So, this is the area I start getting confused as we start getting into this 3.5% mm-hmm. or the withhold area. So would that 3.5% then be on top of these numbers? They're already included in these numbers. Then. Mm-hmm. Thank you. Then I've got some more questions as we get into the 3.5% then. Is my understanding of the exchange is the 3.5% is used to pay for the administrative costs, and this 3.5% is an add-on to the premium that the insurance companies are charging, or they're building it into the premium? Okay, so the insurance companies then are building it, and she's nodding up and down here, so thank you. So the 3.5%, the insurance companies have already added to their premiums in this scenario to cover the cost of the exchange. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, or Madam Chair, Representative, it is correct. It is assumed that this would be part of the premiums that would be presented, and the 3.5% would be included in there.
Okay.
Representative Fisher?
Yes. Oh,
you
thank you. Yes.
Continued questions?
Yes. All right. Thank you. Yes, more questions. Now, this covers the cost of the exchange. Now, any costs that the insurance companies have is something that they would still receive from their part of, they would still have in their part of the premium that they have. Are there any other charges that go back to the insurance companies from the exchange at all when they're dealing? In other words, what I'm thinking of it is usually in business when you have your marketing on a program, there's a certain clawback that happens. In the nonprofit world example, there's donations that you get from a site. You have to pay a fee to that site for that privilege to be there. So is there any fee that the insurance companies are paying to the site to be able to have this business come to them?
Ms. Julek. Madam Chair, Representative, nothing that is envisioned at this time.
Wow. That seems like a great benefit for businesses to be able to do this without having to pay any fees. So this is a free service to businesses that qualify for this.
Ms. Julek, the cost of that service would be embedded in the 3.5%, Madam Chair and Representative.
Right, but the 3.5% is being...
Fisher.
Thank you. So that 3.5% is then being paid by the consumer.
Ms. Julek.
As part, Madam Chair, Representative, as part of the premium, it's...
Okay.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. So this helps clarify a lot of this process right here. So from the perspective of the how the exchange operates, it really does not cost the insurance companies anything at all to be part of this program, correct?
Ms. Julek.
Madam Chair, Representative. The cost would be 3.5% of the premium of whatever is set.
Right.
How that impacts.
However they set up the premium.
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. Yes. Okay. That kind of, I think, helps clarifies a lot what is happening in this area then. It helps clarify a lot of how the 3.5% is operating and who's actually paying it. And the final question I think I have along these lines is then for the people that are qualifying for subsidies on that, their subsidies then help pay for that 3.5% then. Is that correct?
Ms. Julek. Madam Chair and Representative, that is correct. To the extent you are eligible for a subsidy, that your share would be a flat amount, and anything above would be covered by the tax credit.
Okay.
Representative Fisher.
That's the end of my questions. Thank you very much.
Super. Thank you. Next on the list, we have Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. And I'm on page 6 of 46. And it's estimated marketplace participation. Mm-hmm. And yesterday we received testimony, if I remember right, according to my notes, that we need a minimum of 200,000 enrollees into the exchange at 3.5% in order to generate enough revenue to cover the cost of the exchange. Do you it looks like these, you're assuming hundreds of thousands of people will be enrolled in a very short period of time based on this scenario, or am I misreading that?
Ms. Julek, Madam Chair, Representative, What this table represents, so table 16 has the 2016 participation estimates as updated in January by Dr. Gruber, and that would be the 1.295 thousand or million participants, of which 690,000 would be Medicaid. The next table shows a phase-in. There's two steps to the phase-in. And so in calendar year 14...
I'm sorry, where are you at?
Table 2.
Table 2? Okay.
Yep. So table 2 takes those 2016 estimates and assumes that only a portion of them would actually come in that first calendar year. So under the low, as an example, under... let's use the high enrollment scenario... So under calendar year 14 high enrollment scenario for the individual subsidy, it's assumed that 60% of those eligible would come in. And so that's taking from table 1 the 370,000 estimated eligibles and saying 60% would come in calendar year 14. Under the low and medium, it'd be lower, 50% and 40%. And then in addition to that, and so that calculates to about 222,000 people. However, they're not all here January 1st. And so table 3 on page 17 says when do they come in the door?
Table 3 on page 17?
On page 7, I'm sorry. Page
7. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, my mistake there.
So we're on page 7, table 3.
Table 3.
Yep.
And then
Ms.
that Miller. Says, okay, of those, of that 60% figure, that 222,000, about 25% will come in January, another 25 in February, another 18 in March, and then throughout the year you'd have a little more. And that's assumed in the first for Plan 14, there's a 6-month open enrollment period. It's from October through March, and so you'd get a wave in that first 6 months, and then you'd have people as things change coming in and out. The next year. The growth between 14 and 15, you'd assume that 60% of that growth would come in January. Again, the open enrollment for that second year shortened. It's October through December, so most of the growth you'd assume would come in that first part of the year, or a little quicker. So that's how the step down. So it's not assuming on day one that we have the 370,000. It's phased in two different ways, how much for that first year and within that year, how they come in month by month.
Representative Greenhagen, do you have a follow-up?
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. Do you think even on the low side, you know, I've worked in the insurance industry for 30, I've been married 37. I've worked in insurance 35.
A long time, Representative Greenhagen.
Marriages seem short, though, okay? I'm happily
the day married. After Valentine's Day, that's a very good answer. Representative Greenhagen.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. I just think it seems like even on the low side, these are very optimistic enrollment projections, unless I'm seeing some. I looked at the application, and I don't have a copy of it here. I think I got a copy just for the public, and I think it's 21 pages long. I mean, do you have any doubts about these projections being this optimistic even on the low end?
Mr. Lick, Madam Chair, these projections were based on a model, again, by the Wakely Consulting Group using experience from the Massachusetts experience, and so that's how the model was put forth and put together, and that's what was used.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. I'll skip my question since I was on the list, and we'll move to Representative Loeffler.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, and while we're still on that page 6, I would just and the estimated participation, I just think it's important for us because sometimes in the discussion I think we lose track of that, of who's really going to be most active in this exchange. And you know, on table 1, it shows that the non-MA, non-premium tax credit enrollees will be approximately 122,000 or only 10% of the total exchange. You know, about almost 700,000 would be public insurance enrollees, and then there's another, you know, almost 400,000 who are going to get premium tax credits. And so, you know, in terms of just who's attracted in and what percentage of the business, I think that's something that sometimes gets lost as we kind of focus on the new part of it, which we should, which is really reaching out to a totally different segment. But my question was actually related to the statement from Mr. Golden about there's estimated to be $100 million in expenditures in MA enrollment, and that the counties pay the 50% state share. We're used to paying for the state share out of general fund for all kinds of MA programs, but in this circumstance it's paid for by counties out of property taxes. And my question to him would be whether or not, since there's enhanced MA rates for various components of implementing the ACA, whether there's any ability for us to use those enhanced matching rates for in any way in support of the counties, whether it's in buying technology to deal with the new computer systems, whether it's in any other way that we are we fully taking advantage of opportunities to relieve property tax burdens.
Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair and Representative Loeffler, the answer is we are doing everything we can to try to get the enhanced match where it's appropriate and where it's possible. So let me give you two examples. In general, for administrative activities such as working with the clients, it's a 50-50 match. We don't anticipate that for that there is an opportunity to get any enhanced match beyond that. However, when it comes to IT development, there is right now a 90-10 match that the federal government is providing. One of the aspects of IT that is being upgraded is some of the counties have their own document management system, for example, and they are looking to upgrade that as part of managing the clients that are going through that. We are actively exploring right now with CMS the opportunity to be able to get a 90-10 match on county expenditures associated with those activities. We don't have an answer from CMS on that, but it is something that we're exploring. So where there are opportunities for enhanced match, we are looking at where not only can the state benefit from that, but also our county partners.
Well, Representative Loeffler, do you have a follow-up?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Golden. That's helpful. I'd love to get some additional information on that. And I'm just thinking about, you know, if you're using programming that's based on DOS programs that are, you know, 20, 30 years old, there's no incentive for you to upgrade your technology to do faster, smarter things because you're dialing into a system that's on old stuff. And so I'm thinking that there's probably across the state a number of counties, I don't think my county is not one of those, but that have not bothered to upgrade any of their hardware until it fails just because it's not being used for anything that uses that new capacity. And so I'm just wondering, particularly for the rural counties, some of which are just getting into broadband and that sort of thing, if there might be some ways that we could step up.
Mr. Golden.
Madam Chair, Representative Loeffler, we would be happy to provide you with information on what we are trying to do to secure the maximum and certainly let the counties know where that lands on those efforts. And we agree that the systems that we have been using at DHS are in desperate need, and it does cause a lot of additional time and effort even in the counties in trying to work with our clients.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Dean.
Thanks, Madam Chair. Just first of all, from just a process standpoint, we've got about an hour and 45 minutes. We have a hard stop at noon today, and we are coming back on Monday for amendments.
The hard stop is at 11 today.
Oh.
And noon on Monday.
Oh, I thought we were noon today. Okay.
Representative Dean?
Just from, are we going to have specific testifiers? Are there other testifiers who are scheduled? I didn't really see a list of folks who will be coming up, and what's the game plan for the rest of the committee?
Well, it was my understanding, and perhaps I can get some guidance from staff here, but it was my understanding that today would be an opportunity for Q&A about the exchange from the folks that were here and that we'll be taking up amendments and doing more work in that area on Monday. So okay. Is there somebody else? Is there someone you wanted to question that isn't in the room right now that we need to?
Madam Chair, well, Representative Huntley's gone, the author of the bill is gone, and Ms. Melman's gone. I don't know if they're going to be coming back or if they're
will be returning.
Questions or.
And Representative Atkins will be returning as well. If you want to hold a question for them in a little bit, they'll be returning.
Good. Yeah, I just want to use, if we only have 45 more minutes, then I'll probably. I have a couple questions for Ms. Melman on the on some of the contracts. Just first for Ms. Julich, you referenced earlier the Wakely report. Could you please tell me what that is?
Madam Chair, Representative, it's a budget model. It's a Wakely budget model that takes a number of things into account. One, what your enrollment estimates are, what premium information, premium history for individual and small market are, and then it takes a benchmark per member per month costing process to estimate what the expenditures or budget for an exchange would be.
And Representative Dean, I see that a couple of the other folks that you might want to question have come back, including the bill's author, so if you might want to grab him while he's in the room here.
All right.
Or wait till Monday. That's fine, too. Representative Dean.
Thank you. Thanks, Madam Chair. And also, I just from some of the enrollment projections are some of the things that I just want to highlight on that you had brought up earlier from the Gruber-Gorman report that Representative Huntley brought up a figure of 300,000 people who are newly, who currently don't have insurance, who do are projected to have insurance, and I take it that that is the 290 that is referenced in the Gruber-Gorman report, which is a net. Could you just kind of maybe tell me where that comes from?
Ms. Julich.
Madam Chair, I think that's details that maybe Ms. Momloff could answer.
Okay. And perhaps, perhaps you could just walk through me how the gross premium tax works from beginning to end for somebody who just doesn't understand insurance at all, or how this is going to get rolled out or worked. How, just can you walk that through, or is that maybe a better question for somebody else?
Madam Chair, how the withhold would work? Or,
correct.
Okay.
Ms. Drilling.
The withhold would be based on premiums on products purchased through the exchange. So as plans put products on the exchange and participants enroll in those plans and have premiums for those plans, the exchange would know what that total is. There'd be a calculation of a 3.5% on that total, and that would be collected back from the plans.
Representative Dean, I've been told that Ms. Malbov is here, and she would be willing to do the presentation on the Gruber-Gorman report, if that would be helpful to you.
That'd be
I know you were interested in that.
Yeah, that'd be great. Thank you,
okay.
Ma'am.
And Representative Mack, can you wait until after that? All right. Thank you. Ms. Malbov?
Actually, we're going to try to put it up on the screen, I think.
That would be great, and I'm not sure if there's someone here with some technological skill that could help you with the machine up there. I can give you just a moment. And while we wait, Dr. Golden, I'd like to apologize for referring to you as Mr. Golden, although I realize you're still a man, but Dr. Golden would have been appropriate, and I misspoke. Forgive me. Looks like we're up and ready.
We're up and ready. So, Madam Chair and members, I could walk through some of the results from the Gruber analysis.
That would be wonderful. Could you speak your name into the mic for the record, please?
My name is April Todd Mumlove, and I'm the exchange director.
Thank you very much. You may proceed.
So, Madam Chair and members, this is a presentation that I gave on January 11th at our advisory task force meeting. It goes over the methodology and also reports on the updated results from that study. So just to cover the methodology quickly, as I described earlier, we contracted with Dr. Jonathan Gruber. He's an economist at MIT, and Bella Gorman, she is an actuary. And the two of them, we worked on economic and actuarial modeling with them. We contracted with them in 2011 to do an initial report on what the impact of the ACA and the exchange would be on Minnesota. And we got updated results for that this January. So this is to report on the updated results, but the background in here on methodology is the same methodology that applied in both runs of the data. So for the background on the modeling, this models the impact of the ACA. It has two components. It's economic modeling, which is population flows. So it looks at what type of coverage people would have prior to the ACA and what type of coverage they would have after the ACA. So that's what it means by population flows. It also looks at the other side of it is actuarial modeling, and that looks at the impact on insurance pricing. And so it integrates the two of those modeling components together to look at both population movements and cost. And as an example, it looks at the impact on pricing in the market, how that impacts what type of coverage people will have. And it's done in a regurgitative manner through a simulation modeling to estimate both of those impacts. It looks at how policies impact the economy. The key aspect is accounting for how individuals and businesses react to policy interventions or react to the ACA. And it really, the modeling itself builds on health economics research over the past few decades that have been done by multiple experts and brings in the assumptions from multiple past studies. So this is a schematic of the model itself. And so what it does is it brings in data and brings in policy parameters, and it looks at things in a sequential and simulation way. So first it looks at firm behavior. So how will businesses react to changes in the ACA? What kind of coverage will they offer to their employees? And then what are the individual responses to that, both on the employee side and individuals that are buying coverage on their own? So how do they react? And then also incorporate some regulatory actions as well, or how what actions that states might want to incorporate into that. One of the things that we had as a state-specific component that we tested was the impact of the basic health plan, for example, that we incorporated into that part of the model. And the outputs are looking at population flows and cost flows, so looking at the impact on pricing and on the type of coverage that individuals have. So the data that we used, a few different sources. As I mentioned yesterday, the base of the model or the base of the data is our Minnesota Health Access Survey. The first time that we did the modeling, we used the 2009 data. This is updated to reflect 2011. We also include information from our health insurance carriers, our high-risk pool on the individual side of the market, the high-risk pool small group, the 50 to 100 market as well. In the first iteration of the analysis, we used 2009 data. This is updated to 2011. And so we gathered information on enrollment, premiums, risk mix, information on the benefits of all the different products that the carriers offered, and that was through a survey to the carriers and to MSHA, and also to DHS as well. That included equivalent information on enrollments and benefits, risk mix, capitation rates, eligibility requirements that we have in the state, those types of things. And then another component piece of the data is that large group premiums are based on the medical expenditure panel survey. That's the key component of the model for large groups. And again, just to reiterate, this is the 2011 data this time. The previous report was based on 2009 as the base of the model. And so when you look at how the modeling
Mr.
actually...
Chair, Excuse me.
Representative Dean.
Ted Melmoff, in the interest of time, you referenced the earlier report, and is that the April 12th that you're referring as the earlier report?
Yes.
Ms. Melmoff.
And the updated report is your slide deck?
The updated results are from these slides. We are expecting the text around the report by the end of this month. We wanted to make sure that we could get the results out as soon as possible so legislators would have that for the early part of session.
Okay, and we anticipate that this will...
Representative Dean.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. We anticipate that this will pass this committee on Monday and be on the floor for a vote before that happens. Is that your understanding?
Ms. Malmlov, sorry.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, as I mentioned, the report we're expecting by the end of the text around the report by the end of this month.
Thank you. And is the text expected to be significantly different than... Are we going to learn anything different than we're learning in the slides today from that text?
Madam Chair, no. It's just Thank text you. To describe these results.
You may continue.
So how the model actually works, it is a simulation model, and so it goes through many iterations of the data that's there. So it looks at the MSHA impact, plus the impact of the ACA and the actuarial value requirements under the ACA. That is put into the model and has some outputs on what that coverage would be, who will enroll in that coverage. Then it goes through an actuarial process where they look at of those people that will enroll based on the new results or the new requirements under the ACA, what will the new pool of people be that are in the exchange based on their demographics and their age? And that then is put through an actuarial process where it looks at that risk and recalculates the premiums again and then impacts who will enroll, and that's done multiple times to get at kind of the end results, which is what's the impact on premiums and what sources of coverage will people have as a result of the ACA. And so these are the key elements that that the model assumes and that are incorporated into the model. It assumes a Medicaid expansion up to 138% of poverty. It incorporates that there will be tax credits, premium tax credits for individuals between 138% of poverty and to 400% of the federal poverty level. There are some assumptions in here. It assumes that adults in Minnesota Care above that 138 go into the exchange. We also considered some additional options as well around a basic health plan where those adults between 138% and 200% of the federal poverty level would go into a basic health plan instead of going into private plans through the exchange and getting the tax credits.
And Ms. Molnoff, could I ask if that assumption centers around their current Minnesota Care program?
Madam Chair, are you asking about the benefits, or I want to make sure I'm answering your question?
Yeah, whatever assumptions you have are based on kind of where we're moving and the costs surrounding that.
Madam Chair, we looked at a variety of different options for how you could do the basic health plan from... we looked at premium levels, looked at cost-sharing levels, looked at provider rates. We have a whole host of things that I'll actually describe a little bit later.
Thank you.
We also assumed that kids under 275% of the federal poverty level would be in medical assistance. We have a maintenance of effort requirement for kids, and so have to assume that those kids would be in medical assistance. So kids above 275% of the federal poverty level would be in the exchange, but those under would be in medical assistance. The model also incorporates the individual responsibility requirement, or what people refer to as the individual mandate. It also includes the market reforms that come under the ACA that apply market-wide, which are the community rating, guarantee issue, and no pre-existing condition requirements, the minimum actuarial value and essential health benefit set requirements, and the high-risk pool, essentially going away in two different scenarios under guarantee issue. It also incorporates the employer responsibility payments, and what those are, to remind folks, is that if an employer has 50 or more employees, and one of those employees, if they provide coverage to the employee and the employee's premium is more than 9.5% of their income, they're eligible for tax credits through the exchange. If that employee gets tax credits through the exchange, the employer is subject to a $2,000 to $3,000 penalty per employee for that individual getting tax credits. So it incorporates those penalty payments in here. It also incorporates the small employer tax credits. And the small employer tax credits are available for 2 years through to small employers through the exchange. And these are for small businesses that have 25 or less employees, and their average wage is $50,000 or less. And then it also incorporates just the functionality of the exchange itself into the model.
Madam Chair? Excuse me, but if Ms. Todd Melmoth is going to continue with the presentation, and it looks like we're not even halfway through, I'm just wondering if we have time for questions or if we're just going to march through this presentation and not have time for questions. I think several members have specifically on this would like to ask a couple of questions, so that I don't think that it's inappropriate to ask that, or if we could have an extension on the limitation of the time for today's committee.
Talk with Representative Huntley on that, but Representative Dean, I was going to call on you. I just had a question myself.
Okay.
So, so I would have been happy to call on you. I just wanted to ask a question myself, but and I've lost my train of thought a little bit, but my question had to do with the employer responsibility and the fee, the $2,000 fine that you talked about. Is the employee in any way, that with 50 or more, are they in any way required to offer a certain type of policy, or can is there any sort of assumption that perhaps they'll keep it under that 9.5% by offering perhaps a different policy than they currently have in order to keep from paying that $2,000? Is that an option for them, Ms. Malnoff?
Madam Chair, there are some requirements around minimum essential coverage, which does have a 60 kind of percent requirement in there that they offer that. So they do need, there is a minimum level that they have to offer.
Thank you. And I guess my assumption would be that the market will respond to that level and offer products to businesses that would keep them from doing that. Is that a wrong assumption on my part?
There is an assumption that, and you'll see this later in the presentation as well, that there really aren't all that many changes on employer-based coverage, that many people do continue to stay on employer-based coverage and don't drop into the individual market.
Thank you for that clarification. And Representative Dean, by all means, I want you to ask your question, but we also want to get through the presentation. And since it is a Friday, even though the committee won't be meeting, you are all open to calling and getting some of your questions answered the rest of the afternoon. It is a work day, I assume, for the employees of the state, and so they will be at your disposal as well outside this committee. So I do hope people, if they leave and the time is up and there's still questions, you have the afternoon to get them answered offline, and I hope you do. But Representative Dean.
Well, Madam Chair, I appreciate that, and I also know that you appreciate that this is very controversial and that there are a lot of folks who expect us to ask tough questions, not only tough questions of the administration, of the governor's office, of the folks behind this, but also on record. It's very important that before we vote on this, that we have done our job in the HHS Finance Committee.
And Representative Dean, I would hope through the 11 committee hearings that this bill is getting, that all questions will be answered and asked throughout the whole process. But on HHS Finance questions, absolutely, this is the committee to do them.
Well, so let me tell you that I've heard from members that have had voiced a specific complaint that has not been the case.
Well, HHS Finance hopefully will not be one of them, and I encourage you to get to your questions between now and 11. Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is very, very complicated. And a lot of members have been asking me questions, and I just have to say that I am nowhere near up to speed on this as I should be. And so I'm trying to get up to speed as much as I can, looking through the information. But also, I think that it's somewhat telling that there's a bill of this scope that members on the specific committees really do have a lack of fundamental understanding of how the mechanics of this work. I think that that this is moving very, very quickly from time frames. When I look at other states and how they're moving and how they're actually stepping back, it gives me pause when I see the velocity of this bill traveling. It does give me cause for some concern. And that's a question for Representative Adkins, not for Ms. Todd-Melmoff. But the question that I have is specifically with this report. When I look at this, I say, this committee looks at enrollment numbers, it looks at projections, it looks at how much is this going to cost, who's going to get covered, how much are we going to, you know, what are the effects. So this Gruber-Gorman report is really important for the decision that we have to make whether or not this goes ahead and how. And so that's why I'm kind of just focused on that as I'm trying to absorb this as best I can. And I look at this in the contract that we have with this particular consulting firm. I see is about $350,000 for the total contract, or is it more than that or less than that?
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I don't have the contract in front of me, but I think right around that amount sounds about right.
And Madam Chair and Ms. Todd-Melmoff, about what percentage of that contract is completed with the work that they have thus far? Do you know?
Well, we have, Madam Chair and Representative Dean, so we have a contract and then we also have an amendment. The first contract has been completed. They are working under the amendment. And I think I'd have to ask Ms. Julek, but I think that we have paid the portion related to the modeling work, and then there's another payment that comes at the end when the report is done. And so we haven't made that payment because the report is not done yet.
For the record, Ms. Julek is nodding her head behind you. Representative Dean, before you go on, and I encourage you to do so, Representative Huntley has to leave at 11. If the committee would like, we could stay a little bit longer to make sure all your questions are answered, and I could certainly stay here and chair till noon. So just keep that in the back of your head.
I appreciate that. Thank
Representative
you, Madam
Dean.
Chair. I'm looking at the fiscal note on page 8 of 46, and under subdivision 6, or Section 6, Subdivision 5. There's a number in here that I can't find anywhere else, either in the Gruber-Gorman report or anywhere else. And that is in the second or third to the bottom sentence. It's the reduction in enrollment could range from 0 to 202,000 employees. That number is a couple of different places. Could you tell me where that 202 comes from?
Ms. Mamla.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, the 202 represents the individuals and small businesses that would not be getting tax credits that are projected that could participate in the exchange.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Ms. Todd-Melmoff. That comes from the annotated or updated Gruber-Gorman report. Is that where that number comes from?
Madam Chair, Representative. It is actually represented, if you look at Table 1 on page 6, it incorporates the individuals and employees of small businesses that would not be eligible for the tax credits. That's the 202 on the high end represents the addition of those numbers.
All right. Thank you,
Representative Dean, do you want to keep asking questions or do you want to finish going through?
Yep.
And then Representative Mack and Representative Liebling have questions. Is it on this point or do you want her to finish with her presentation? Representative Mack and Representative Liebling?
I can wait.
Okay. Representative McElwain, Representative Liebling?
Well, Madam Chair, I really just wanted to respond to what Representative Dean said before. It's really more, my comment was really more on the process than on the substance here, but you know, I just wanted to comment. Representative Dean's worried that he won't have time for his questions. Well, before he gave a vigorous defense of Representative Grunhagen wasting our time talking about things other than the bill. And I just want to say that the minority really can't have it both ways. It's wonderful to ask questions. This is a serious matter. You should spend time getting at serious questions. But I've heard the same questions over and over, and I think some of them even in the same committee hearings. Representative Huntley gave lots of time in this committee, and he planned this out very carefully to allow plenty of time. As I understood it, yesterday's hearing was with witnesses, where there was plenty of time allowed for questioning witnesses. He gave Representative Abler some latitude to question the staff who were there last night because Representative Abler said he could not be here today to do what was planned for today, which was talk to Ms. Malmov and the other staff. So we had yesterday's hearing, which was very long. We have had today's hearing, which was supposed to be an opportunity to question the staff, and then Monday is supposed to be for amendments and questions and testimony to those amendments so that we can get to a vote. And I'm just concerned that there's an attempt here to drag this out and try to run out the clock. I certainly hope that's not the case, but it has seemed to be the case as we've moved this bill along. So I'm going to stop talking, Madam Chair, and hope that we can get to the substance of this and get through the substance of this, because as the minority knows, they had 2 years to do this. They could have had the bill of their dreams, and they didn't move the bill. And so I think it's time to stop playing games and get this thing done. Thank you.
Thank Madam you, Chair, I absolutely have to defend myself. Representative Liebling, your characterization of the minority asking questions as playing games is, of course, inappropriate. The characterization that we are somehow concerned about moving forward in a deliberate manner, that's our job, Representative Liebling, and you know that. As a chair of a committee, you should understand that perfectly well. We've got legitimate questions to ask. We also have a very legitimate question about why Minnesota is moving ahead relative to other states and relative to this timeline. These are legitimate questions from the business community, from the community that you represent in Rochester, Representative Liebling. I hear from enough folks in Rochester to understand that you know that you're hearing from the same constituents of yours that I am, to understand that it is our job to ask these questions, and we do so deliberately and with great professionalism, seriousness. So I appreciate your concern.
And members, we know this is an issue that has had a lot of history behind it. We have been talking about it for a good 3 years now, and we just have to respect each other's differences, and I do hope that we do keep our questions to Ms. Malmov, and I keep mispronouncing your name, I apologize, it doesn't roll off my tongue very easily, but we ask questions of her so that we can move ahead and make informed decisions and work on those amendments that we have coming, which will be the opportunity for the minority and the majority to make this bill in the best form it can be when we move it out of committee. That's our ultimate goal in here, not, you know, and I don't think it benefits us at this point to argue about the process. I'd like to continue on with the process instead. And so, Representative Mack, and then I would like to get back to the presentation if we could.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And that's just to this point. Mr. Berg and I here are quick trying to add up numbers, and maybe just in the interest of saving our time and calculators, can you tell me what two numbers in Table 1 are adding up to that 202? Or what numbers specifically? I might be picking the wrong ones to add up here, but I'm just looking for that.
Ms. Malmov, or perhaps Ms. Julek?
80, the 90, and the 24.
Go to slide 13. It's a lot easier.
Yeah. Madam Chair, Representative Mack, it's also on a later slide as well. These numbers are also in there, but it is adding up three different numbers.
Okay.
So it's those that are not receiving the tax credit. So enrollees and firms, less than 50 not receiving the tax credit. There's 98,000 there. Enrollees and firms, 50 to 99, there's 24,000 there. And non-tax credit recipients in reformed market of 80,000 there.
Okay, Madam Chair, just a quick follow-up.
Representative Mack.
How do you, and Ms. Malmov, how do you get to those assumptions for those numbers? Is that out of the Gruber and Gorman report that's coming from?
Ms. Malmov.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, yes, they are, and they're actually numbers that are on the next slide.
Okay, I'll pay attention.
So if we could move to the next slide, that'd be great.
So what we did, as I mentioned, part of the modeling is to look at population flows, so shifts in coverage from with the ACA and without the ACA. And we also looked at the impact on enrollment if you did a BHP or if you didn't do a BHP. And so there's two separate slides here looking at enrollment. So the first part of this table looks at employer-sponsored insurance. That's what ESI means. And so we looked at under a no-reform scenario in 2016 and with the ACA in 2016. And broke that down as well for the populations that the exchange is designed to serve. And so that's small firms with 50 or less employees and firms with 51 to 100 employees. So under a no-reform scenario, you have over 3 million people in Minnesota in employer-sponsored insurance, and you have roughly the same amount that are in employer-sponsored insurance after the ACA. There's a small reduction of 3,000 employees that would not be in employer-sponsored insurance as a result of the ACA. For small firms in Minnesota, prior to the ACA, there are about 420-some thousand employees in small group coverage, or that is what it would be anticipated in 2016. With the ACA, that's 426,000. Again, really no difference here, an increase of 6,000 there. And for employers with 51 to 100 employees, under no reform, a little over 100,000. And with the ACA, again, around 100,000, so small reduction there of 9,000. What the unreformed individual market means is the individual market without the ACA reforms. And so that in 2016 was projected around 290,000. With the ACA, that's projected to be 7,000. And who that 7,000 represents, it's two groups of people. One are those people that choose to grandfather their plans. So people are allowed to stay in the same plan that they had prior to the ACA if they want to. And so this represents that group of individuals, which is actually very small. It's projected that people will move into other plans over time. And it also represents a small share of the MSHA population. So this analysis assumes a three-year phase-out of MSHA, and so it assumes a very small number of those MSHA enrollees that are still in MSHA in 2016 in that last year. And so then what the reformed individual market represents is the individual market with all of the ACA reforms, around 530,000 individuals there. We also looked at public insurance as well. Under the no reform scenario, this would be about 556,000 individuals. And I do want to highlight a change here in a change in enrollment from the last report that we did. So the report based on 2009 data compared to 2011 data, there is more public program enrollment anticipated here in the new report. As opposed to the previous report, and that is actually following trends that DHS has seen over the past few years of increasing enrollment in our public programs. Under the ACA, public insurance would be projected to increase, and that is coming from the Medicaid expansion, from the individual mandate. More people eligible for public programs are going to be coming into public programs, and so that increase is about 55,000 individuals. The one thing I wanted to highlight here as well that is a difference from the last report is that this number, this increase in public programs, is less than what the increase was in the last report. And the difference there is that we're seeing in the survey data that the economy is improving. And so incomes are going up. And so as those incomes go up, less people are eligible for public programs, but they are more likely to be eligible for the basic health plan. So their incomes are going up a little bit, so they're not eligible for Medicaid, but they would be eligible for that basic health plan population or for the exchange if the state did not do that program. And then the last line is the uninsured. So without reform, the uninsured in Minnesota is projected around 500,000 people. It's about 9% of the population. With the ACA, that's projected to go down to 200,000, roughly, individuals. And so the ACA impact is around reduction in 300,000 individuals. So we also looked at the estimate of the ACA in 2016 if the state did a basic health plan. And so the basic health plan is a program very similar to Minnesota Care, between 138% of poverty and 200% of the federal poverty level, which under the law, it essentially would take 95% of the tax credits that people could get in the exchange, gives that to the state, and allows them to do a state-based program for that income group. very similar to what we do in Minnesota today for Minnesota Care. So the differences here in this slide versus the previous slide are primarily around the reformed individual market, the public insurance, and the uninsured. And so what you'll see here is the reformed individual market goes down because those individuals would go into technically a public program, and so there you see a reduction there. Public insurance increases equivalently, and you see the uninsured could be the same or could be a little less than what you saw in the previous slide. And the reason for that is that we looked at, to Representative Norton's point, we looked at a variety of ways that you could do the basic health plan in terms of how you establish the premiums, how you establish the cost sharing, how you set that up. The more generous that you would make a program like a basic health plan or like Minnesota Care, the more people that you get enrolled and the less uninsured that you would see. So we saw a swing there of about 40,000 individuals depending on how generous you made that program. So this slide then goes to predicting the size of the exchange. This table should look very similar to the one in the fiscal note that you see on page 6, table 1. And so this looks at, without a BHP and with a BHP, what the enrollment in the exchange in different categories would look like. So that first row there is the tax credit recipients. So these are individuals that would be eligible for the tax credit. So if you didn't do a BHP, it would be about 370,000 individuals. With a basic health plan type program for those people between 138 and 200% of the federal poverty level, that's at 217,000 because you're taking those people out of individual and putting them into that public program.
We have a question. Representative Grunhagen.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks for the presentation. We were given a graph earlier that in Minnesota we have about 0.2% of our population that are not covered either by a government program or health insurance currently. And of that 9.2, approximately 6% are eligible for a government program. So they're not motivated today to sign up for a government program. And yet, so how are they going to be motivated? Are they going to be imposed a penalty and then the IRS is going to go after them if they don't sign up to pay the penalty? Or how do you attempt to motivate these people to take action when they haven't taken action in the last decade or whatever?
Ms. Momla.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, there are a variety of reasons why people will enroll in insurance. The first one is around just the individual mandate, that will entice people to enroll in coverage. Some people will be subject to the penalty and some won't be. There's also the ability for assistance for people to get as well through the subsidies, that will encourage people as well to enroll in coverage. One of the things that I would mention here is this is the same type of model that was also used in Massachusetts. And what they found in Massachusetts was actually that the uninsured went down more than what they projected. So the reduction in the uninsured in Massachusetts, following a very similar model to this, predicted about 60% of the uninsured would get coverage. Actually, in Massachusetts, one of the evaluations of that study that was in the National Bureau of Economic Research showed that their uninsured actually went down by 70%. So it went down more than what they had projected. And in Massachusetts, the uninsurance rate there today is less than 2%.
Madam Chair,
thank
just
you, Representative Grunhagen.
Okay, but whether it's 70% or whatever, the fact is you're going to have a certain percentage that won't. Is that where the IRS comes in and tries to collect that penalty from those individuals that don't sign up for the program?
Ms. Momla.
Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen, some of those that don't sign up on coverage and that remain uninsured, yes, some of them will choose to pay the penalty.
And the IRS would be?
Representative Grunhagen.
Yeah, Madam Chair. The IRS would be the one that would be charged with the responsibility of collecting that penalty.
Ms. Momla, but I believe that is outside this state's purview, but you may have the answer to that.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, yes, the IRS would have that penalty.
Okay.
Thank you. I think you have the last section here yet, or do you have a little bit more on this slide?
On this slide a bit. So what you'll see in the second row are enrollees in firms less than 50 that would be eligible for that small business tax credit, and that's around 33,000 employees of small businesses. The third line down are people in the individual market that are not eligible for the tax credits. And there are about 160,000 of these individuals. Under assumptions that Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman have, they project that up to 80,000 of those would participate in the exchange. Enrollees, the next line is enrollees in firms with less than 50 employees not receiving the tax credit. And this is a population of about 390,000 employees. They project that around a fourth of them would participate in the exchange, 25% of them. The line under that are enrollees in firms with less than between 51 and 100 employees. And in this represents around 100,000 employees of those businesses, again, around a fourth of them projected to participate in the exchange. And then the last line is public insurance enrollees of 690,000 individuals. There would be much higher if you did a basic health plan. And one of the things to mention here is that this number is different than some of the prior slides that you saw, where there was, I think, 811,000. The reason for that difference is that that previous number of 811,000 included the disabled in there that are under the age of 65. This number does not include the disabled because they do not, their standard of eligibility is not under the modified adjusted gross income that the that are required that would go through the exchange. So that doesn't include the disabled in this number. So then the next part of the study was looking at the premium impact. And so under the ACA, one of the impacts on premiums is that there will be more comprehensive coverage required under the ACA, both inside and outside the exchange, so broadly speaking, where there's a requirement to have coverage at a 60% actuarial value. And what that means is that of the expenses of a plan, 60% of them are covered by the carrier, and 40% are covered outside of the premium by the enrollee through cost sharing. So that's what the actuarial value essentially means. And so what they looked at, and this is work that Bella Gorman had done as a part of this study, is they collected information from the carriers as to the actuarial value of the products that are currently offered in the market today. And so this is a description of where those actuarial value values are in the market today. So for the individual market, that's the blue bar, you'll see that, you know, the average is around, or the median is around a 60% actuarial value already in the individual market. In the small group market, the actuarial value is actually much higher, where that centers more around a 70% range for actuarial value. One of the interesting things that is different in terms of results from this study versus the previous report is that Bella Gorman is one of I think one of the most respected actuaries in the country. She was selected by HHS to be one of the testers for the actuarial value calculator that recently came out from the federal government. And so that actuarial value calculator, she had expertise in seeing that for the second study that wasn't available for the first study, so was able to see how that calculator would actually work. And so what she saw from that is that what she was projecting as an impact from more comprehensive coverage in the previous report was a much higher impact on premiums of around 8 to 11%. Actually, using the actuarial value calculator for this, the impact is much lower of around 4%. So what she saw there was that what she would have thought under, you know, her expertise in defining that actuarial value is that something that she would have thought was a 60% actuarial value under the AV calculator is actually more like a 65% actuarial value, because that calculator is not taking in as much comprehensive information around the benefit sets as she normally would do in her practice. And so that's one of the differences here when you're seeing the impact on premiums. So a summary of the impact on the premiums is on this slide. So for the individual market, they looked at what the average premium would be without the ACA reforms, and that's around $3,900 for an average person. The premium impact from the ACA reforms, and again, these are the reforms that apply market-wide, not just to the exchange. So the impact of the actuarial value levels, the impact of guarantee issue and modified community rating, all of those things that apply market-wide, would increase premiums by 15 to 29%. And there's some factors in there that have to do with that range. After the application of tax credits, which are only available through the exchange, so at the average premiums for consumers would fall by over 30%. So after people got tax credits, their premium would fall by over 30%. And approximately 70% of the individual market, as you saw in the previous slide, would be eligible for these tax credits. So they would not experience these premium increases at all. On the small group market side, they saw that there would be no increase in premiums from the ACA reforms, and actually a likely reduction due to a managed competition effect. And what they look at in terms of a managed competition effect is literally just the existence of the exchange. So making information available to consumers in an easy place, making it easily comparable, and really, you know, making things very visible in an apples-to-apples comparison way for people to be able to choose their insurance. So these are the component pieces of premium impact. The first few rows are those related to the ACA broadly, and those apply inside and outside the exchange. The managed competition effect is for the exchange only. So under the actuarial value requirement, and again, this is ensuring a minimum level of coverage, so the minimum essential health benefit set and an actuarial value of 60%, that would be around 4%. With the BHP, that would be a little bit less. Then we looked at two different ways of how you would deal with the high-risk pool. The first one assumes that MSHA would end on January 1st of 2014. And the reason that we looked at that, I think some of you may be aware, there is a proposed rule out from the federal government that would essentially provide a very strong incentive for Minnesota to end its high-risk pool on January 1st of 2014. And the reason for that has to do with the reinsurance mechanism. What the feds have put out in the proposed rule is that the reinsurance mechanism will be a national mechanism and that MSHA would not qualify to be able to get those reinsurance funds. So we essentially would be getting money would be taken out of Minnesota and given to other states, would not come back to us, and so there would be an incentive there to make sure that those individuals could be in plans that would receive that reinsurance payment. And we also looked at MSHA as a three-year phase-out. And so this is the recommendation that has been coming from the MSHA board, that they phase out over a three-year period of time and what the impact of that would be to the exchange. And what you'll see there is if you move everyone at the same time, it's about a 21% impact. If you do a three-year phase-out, it's about a 16% impact to the market.
Ms. Pomlov, I think we have a question from Representative Grunhagen. Is it on this point here?
It's similar. It's a comment you made earlier, Madam Chair. And, you know, the I do have to leave at 11, too, and I have a business I have to take care of. But the Kaiser Family Foundation says uninsured rate for Massachusetts is 4%. I believe you gave a different figure, or do you agree with that 4% figure?
Yes, Mamlov.
Madam Chair, Representative Grunhagen, I was referring to a survey that's done by the state of Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. And Madam Chair.
Representative
Grunhagen. Yeah, I have to leave, so I just want to make a statement that the I do consider. Yeah, it's very short. I do consider the marriage penalty in the exchange, as far as the subsidy, to be a major issue. We will continue to hear about it more and more because I am going to raise the issue, and I believe it is pertinent to our discussion. I would like to work on a bipartisan basis to address that issue, because I believe we should not be discriminating against marriage as far as the tax credit is concerned. And ladies, you're the one that carries the most negative consequences when we undermine traditional marriage. Thank you.
Representative Grunhagen, Monday would be an appropriate time, and I think the deadline for amendments is soon. So I would encourage you to get your amendment on, and we can have further discussion next week. We have a little bit more on this slide, and then we're wrapping up. Ms. Mamlov.
So, Madam Chair, the next line is looking at the new risk mix of the individual market pool. And so that is really all of these new individuals that are coming in and getting insurance coming into the pool. The reason for the difference between the no BHP and the BHP is that based on the data that we have, that population between 138 and 200% of the population, or 200% of poverty, is a sicker population. So that population that we have in Minnesota Care today in that income group is sicker than the population over 200% of poverty. So if you put them in the exchange, it increases premiums more than if you kept them out of the exchange. So if you put them in the basic health plan and take them out of the risk pool for the exchange, you'd get a lower premium increase on that side.
And Ms. Mamlov, is that based on what happened in Massachusetts or just part of their actuarial model?
Madam Chair, that's based on data, Minnesota-specific data, at the risk mix of individuals that are in our public programs and in our commercial market.
Thank you for that clarification.
And then the next line, again, is around managed competition, and I've already talked a bit about essentially what that means. And so then that's where you get this range of the 15 to the 29% differential that's here. One of the things I wanted to point out is the some of the numbers that have been referenced from the previous report where the average increase was 29% in the last report. The equivalent number in this report is 23%. And much of the reason for the decline in the premium impact is really that we know more about how the actuarial value calculator is going to work, and that the impact on premiums from having more comprehensive coverage is not as large as we thought in the previous report.
So to clarify, you're saying the 23% is more accurate?
Madam Chair,
number.
Yes.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, I think I would open this next part up to the committee, whether they're interested in hearing this next part or not. These are around the specific basic health plan options that we modeled. I know that the committee wants to end at 11, so I think I would leave it up to the members as to whether or not they're interested in this. This is less pertinent to this part of the bill.
Members, I'm looking for some head nods here because we can continue on and do the last three slides, or if there are more questions, we have a minute ago. I saw Representative Atkins, who's here, and some others. I think he's someplace. We can bring him back up here to get your questions answered. And as I said, I'm happy to stay till noon, and those of you that have continued questions can stay. Those that have to leave certainly are welcome to leave. So would you like to see the last three slides? I'm seeing a lot of no's, and Representative Dean?
I was just going to say, I think that we've just got probably a few more questions from Representative Mack.
We'll answer the questions. I just didn't know if you want her to finish these three slides or not. That's okay. Let's not have the slides, and if anyone has questions on these last three slides, you can follow up, and then we can answer questions now of Ms. Malmlov or others. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have a few questions, so if you need to rotate away from me and then come back, that's
fair.
Okay,
well, let's start, and we'll see if others have, and be thinking if you have questions.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Malmlov, kind of to wrap a couple things here into one question. One thing that I've seen referenced in multiple committees, and I know it was referenced in the past committee I sat on and has been brought up, is a document brought forward by Ms. Commit that talks about the individual market premium impacts before the subsidies are applied. And I haven't heard that disputed necessarily, so I'm assuming that's correct. And as I look at the numbers there and the numbers that you have in the 2016 premium impact page, they're not numbered here, but this says that the impact of the ACA reforms, not including tax credits, will increase premiums by 15 to 29%. So that kind of lines up with what Ms. Commit passed out. She has a best estimate of increase at 29%. So my question is on your slide here, after that, it points out that after the application of tax credits, the average premium will go down by 30%. My question is, though, is that not everybody in the individual market will go into the exchange. And so if, for the average person out there that doesn't go into the exchange, they will, in fact, see a 29% increase on their premiums. That seems outlined here on your slide and lines up with what Ms. Commit passed out. Is that accurate?
Ms. Mama.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that is accurate, and that is just the impact of the ACA market-wide. That is correct.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Ms. Malmlov. And I think that's just an important point because I recognize and I hear from the author and many folks about the average savings that we're going to see because of this exchange. And that might be true in many cases, but I think if we're going to be honest with our constituents, we have to approach this much like we approach runs. When we get numbers for our school districts, when we get numbers for LGA, when we get numbers, you go and you find your district and you look, and there's winners and there's losers as a result of any proposal. And I think that's very much the case in this situation, and I just think it's something we need to be very honest about instead of saying that, you know, everyone on the table is going to see a $400 to $1,700 savings. A more accurate statement would be some people will see savings, other people are going to see huge increases It's just a matter of where you fall in the pot. And so I guess if you want to respond to that, if I'm missing something there, but to me that's a much more accurate depiction of what this legislation is going to do.
And Ms. Malma, you know who you are. if you answer this, could you also answer, is anyone excluded from using the exchange to purchase insurance as part of that answer?
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, no one's excluded from using the exchange to do that. The $490 figure that's been referenced, that of its average savings, is an average savings for all of those individuals. And so those of them that would be going in the exchange would actually get a much higher savings. But to your point, individuals above 400% of the federal poverty level because of more comprehensive coverage and, you know, those individuals in MSHA, you know, going into the individual market and having more choice, not being turned down for coverage, you know, that will result in some premium increases.
Thank you for that.
Is
there anyone else that has questions? Representative Mack was kind enough to at least offer us the opportunity to slide someone else in if they have one. If not, Representative Mack, continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for that honest answer. And I know that that's something that I'm being asked by constituents, if they'll see premium increases. And I said, you know, it really just happens to depend on where you fall on the income scale, whether or not you're going to see a significant difference in your health premiums in the next couple of years, which is obviously concerning for a lot of folks. One question I have in regards to both the fiscal note and your slides, I continually see the 2016 year reference for all numbers and estimates, and I guess I'm just wondering why did we start with 2016? Why not the next 2 years?
Ms. Mommel.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, the reason why we chose 2016 is really that we wanted to see what the full impact of the ACA would be. And so based on discussions with Dr. Gruber and Bella Gorman, you know, their estimates are that it will take about 3 years to get to the full impact of what the ACA would be. And so we were really looking at kind of what that full impact would be. In terms of the fiscal note and some of the enrollment estimates that are there, we assumed that the 2016 would be the full impact. And so that's kind of the high enrollment scenario that's there. Ms. Julek could also talk in detail about this as well. But we have been working with Wakely Consulting Group, which you know, the executives of that group were working in Massachusetts when the connector went in. And so they did have firsthand experience of what those first few years do look like. And so we were working with them to get a sense of, okay, if this is the max, what are those first few years going to look like? And so that's where those low, medium, and high scenarios come from, and where the 14 and 15 scenarios come from to get those lower numbers in the initial years.
And I do have a question from Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to say that everybody, I think, here, everybody in the legislature acknowledges that the Affordable Care Act is not perfect. And certainly the exchange isn't perfect. It won't be perfect. It'll have to be adjusted as time goes on. And so nobody should expect perfection, just as we never expect perfection from any policy around here, especially a brand new policy. So let's all just acknowledge that. But I also want to say that the way I view the exchange part of the ACA is this is an attempt to make a broad reform of our system while keeping private insurance in the game. And one of the alternatives here would have been to take private insurance out altogether, which in my view would have created a much better, easier to manage, less complicated, less expensive overall system. But we don't have that. And just responding briefly to Representative Dean, my constituents are not telling me they don't like the exchange. On the contrary, they like what we're doing here, including active purchaser. But I want to ask Ms. Malmov while I have her here. We've been talking a lot in, you know, hearing Representative Mack's question, which I think is very legitimate, and that a very legitimate point to bring up. But we don't ever seem to be talking here about what this is going to mean for insurance companies. And I wonder if you have any information on that. How is this going to affect the bottom line for insurance companies? And I mean the overall picture. Because we've got insurance companies under this reform, under the ACA generally, are going to have a lot more customers. And many of them are coming in with subsidies. And so we hear a lot of sort of hue and cry from the insurance industry about, oh my gosh, 3.5% of premiums and all of that, and they're all concerned that they're not going to, we've heard sort of a suggestion that maybe they won't want to play because the exchange will be too stringent for them if we have active purchaser and stuff like that. So I wonder if you have any information or any projections about what will happen to the bottom line for insurance companies under this. Are they still going to be profitable?
Ms. Momloff.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, you know, I don't really see the exchange in any way impacting their profitability. It will bring in substantially hundreds of more thousands of individuals into insurance coverage, and they will have a strong desire to do so. And so, you know, people getting tax credits, the plans won't have to work as hard to get these people enrolled in coverage. They're going to want to enroll, and the exchange will make it much easier for people to get enrolled in coverage. So, one, it increases enrollment, increases revenue for them, and I think would make their lives a bit easier in attracting enrollment.
Follow-up, Representative.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Malmov, there was also a comment made yesterday by Ms. Commit, and it went by pretty quickly, but she was asked, I think, about savings on advertising and savings on underwriting, and she seemed to minimize those and say that those weren't very much of that they didn't spend much on that anyway, so they weren't going to save much. Do you have any information or any estimates on those kinds of savings for insurance?
Ms. Pomeroy.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling, I don't have that handy with me, but it is something that both the Health Department and the Commerce Department track, and I think is available on their websites. We could probably get that back to the committee very quickly.
Thank you. Representative Mack, you had another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just back to the issue of how we get to an idea of what these numbers look like, and I understand why 2016 was chosen, and it does make a lot of sense. However, as we try to represent the folks that are going to be impacted by this over the next 2 years, you know, yes, there's going to be a lot of fluctuations. Those fluctuations are people that are going to be trying to navigate this new system and understand what's happening with their health insurance and their options and everything else. And so I guess I'm just wondering, I think you referenced that there are some numbers on 2014 and 2015, if I heard you right, or you can correct me, but I'm just wondering, do we have those in front of us? If not, could you get those to us?
Ms. Momloff.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, those are the numbers that are in the fiscal note, and that's from some discussions and conversation with Wakely, with what their experience was in Massachusetts in those initial years. So, and I think on the fiscal note, if you go to page, where is this? So if you go to page, I think page 6 and 7, those represent the assumptions for 2014 and 2015, kind of what percent of kind of that maximum could come in those initial years and under a low, medium, and high scenario.
Okay. Madam Chair.
Representative Mack.
If I can understand the interaction of the Wakely report and the Gruber and Gorman report, they're cross-referenced a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
If I understand, does the Wakely report give us the 2014-2015 numbers? Gruber-Gorman gives us everything beyond that. Is that how those two interact, or are they? What's the interaction of those two reports that we hear cited?
Ms. Mama.
Yes. So the Gruber-Gorman report is the 2016, so that's like the full impact of the ACA. We consulted with, had conversations with Wakely Consulting just to get, wanted to get a sense of what their initial first few years look like, because we wanted to make sure that these estimates were as accurate as we could possibly get, and that we were including in estimates on the low enrollment side that that would reflect that. And I think as you see here on the low enrollment scenario for 2014, on the individual subsidy side, it's like it's 40% of what the max is. For those on the non-subsidy side, 10% of what that would be. For small group, about 2% on the low enrollment side. So really wanted to make sure that that we were figuring that in.
Thank you. Representative Fisher, you had a question?
Yes, thank you. It has to do with going back to insurance companies, and I'm not too sure if our current testifier can answer this or not, is in terms of the industry as a whole in the healthcare insurance industry right now, what percentage of the dollars coming in drops to the bottom line as a profit? Do you know if you, out of every dollar, is it 5 cents, 5% that drops to the bottom line as a profit? Is it 50%? Do you have an idea what that might be?
Representative Momloff.
Madam Chair, thank you for the the upgrade to Representative
Martin. Oh, I didn't even notice.
So, Madam Chair, Representative, I don't have those numbers in front of me. Working as the previous state health economist, what I am very familiar with is the administrative cost levels that exist in Minnesota for our carriers, and generally on average, they've been around less than 10% for many years.
So if we're figuring around...
Representative Fisher.
Thank you. So we're looking around 10%. When we were talking, going back to Representative Liebling, saying there might be a little bit of savings, that might be a 1% savings, that in turn turns around to be a 10% increase in the profits on the bottom line then, if you're thinking about administrative costs that they wouldn't have. So in some areas, while it may not seem like a lot, it just takes a little bit at this is at the 10% level, if their profits are lower than that, say if the profits were 5%, all of a sudden a 1% actually nets them a 20% increase in their profits on the bottom line. So I think it's very important, going back to Representative Liebling's comment, is that while savings may seem very tiny, when you're talking about something that would drop straight to the bottom line, that can have a huge impact in the profitability for our insurance company. So I want to make sure that we're keeping that part of the component in mind as we're looking at the entire exchange, is there some potential for some great profits here also.
And I don't know that was more of a statement than asking a question, so I have Representative Dean with a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, first of all, I've just a couple quick questions, but first of all, if there's somebody from plans or insurance that would like to respond to either Representative Fisher or Representative Liebling that might be able to provide more background on what we're going to see in Minnesota. And I see someone here.
Looks like we have someone who's going to respond. You state your name, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Barsh. I represent Medica. I'll try to respond to some of Representative Liebling's and some of Representative Fisher's questions, but I'd be happy to answer others. In terms of the cost or potential savings or enrollment that we look at when we see the opportunity that the exchange is presenting, I think all of us are aware that the whole goal of the Affordable Care Act is to increase the number of people with coverage, and we certainly hope that's the case in Minnesota. I think the estimates that they've done in Gruber Gorman are that 290,000 people that are currently uninsured would become insured. I would note that a large percentage of that are people that will be enrolled in the Medicaid program, not entering the commercial insurance market. So there certainly is the potential for all of us to increase our enrollment. When you look at the exchange in particular, there is a significant cost to health carriers of participating in the exchange. And I think sometimes we don't understand that, so if you give me a second, I'll walk through it. The first is...
And if we need to keep this short, because yesterday was public testimony day. We want to get questions of Ms. Momloff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The information technology infrastructure that the exchange is building, we need to connect to that. And so we are all making significant investments in our information technology infrastructure to connect to the exchange as well, and also the federal government. There's exchanges of information and dollars with both the state, the insurance exchange, and the federal government. Those need to be kept up on an ongoing basis. That's a significant investment. I'd also point out that for people who enroll in the exchange, in particular, those people who get a premium tax credit subsidy and or a cost-sharing subsidy, there's a significant potential for loss with insurance carriers. Anyone who gets a tax credit subsidy in the exchange, if they don't pay their premium, the insurance company is still required to pay 100% of their claims for a month. We don't get to stop paying claims and wait till they catch up. We have to pay their claims for a full month, even if they don't catch up and ever pay premiums again. So there actually is a medical loss associated potentially with people who get a tax credit subsidy purchasing through the exchange. This is another potential cost. In terms of the savings that might be attributed through the exchange taking on functions that we currently do, I don't anticipate the exchange to be marketing for Medica. I certainly anticipate the exchange to be marketing for the exchange, but it's still my responsibility as a company to market myself versus Blue Cross, Health Partners, Preferred One, any national carrier that might come in. So I don't think that's a cost that goes away. In terms of underrating costs, it's true that health underrating won't be a factor in the individual and small group market. It will continue to be a factor in the large group market, and we will still need to underrate in the individual and small group market based on age, geography, and an overall risk pool. So I don't think the savings are significant, and there are actually additional costs.
And thank you. And I think the point here is we're all making some assumptions because we don't know the answer. This is new, and we're going to have to tread very carefully as we move ahead. Thank you, and back to Ms. Momloff. Representative Dean, did you have another question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Ms. Momloff, just before we kind of move forward with this, just kind of going back to the report, if somebody from the department could email me just where you are with the Gruber-Gorman contract, how many dollars we have out with them, that would be really great. And then whatever data that you have that was supplied to MMB, if that would be for the fiscal note, for the creation of the fiscal note that is not included from Gruber-Gorman, if we could have that. And the reason for that is that what we have, we're relying on this report. We spent hundreds of thousands of dollars on it for projections for enrollment and for cost. We want to make sure that before we take action on the floor that we have the best, most accurate information. If we don't have their final report, which I would argue that we should have, that we have all of the data that we paid for available to the legislators who are going to be asked to make a vote on that on the floor. And so that I would just put out as a request from the committee.
Ms. Malmov, you look like you might have a comment to make.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, we can absolutely get you kind of the financial status of the contract. We can get that to you. In terms of data that is not in the fiscal note that we submitted in for MMB, there isn't any additional information there.
Representative Dean.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sorry, I misspoke. I didn't mean the fiscal note. I meant the data that is not included in their previous report. You have updated, including pieces of that in your slide deck, whatever shape it's in. Obviously, that you said we're waiting for text. We've got this, but it's not complete. Just whatever data set that you have, if it's a Excel spreadsheets or whatever it is that we used to construct your slide deck from, with assumptions about it from the contract. The state contract with Gruber and Gorman, we just want to make sure that we have the most accurate information and unfiltered information for legislators so that that is publicly available before that we have to vote on that on the floor.
Representative Dean, I did clarify earlier that this does reflect an accurate response, and I think if she can fulfill the request, she will. But I think we need to make a point that we are all reliant on accurate results because this is a product that the state of Minnesota and all of us on both sides of the aisle and the department are hanging their hat on. And so every single one of us benefits by the most accurate information to move ahead with. So I think we all share your concern. And if you want to reassure us again that this is as accurate as it gets and that, you know, where it stands with that text, please feel free to do so, Ms. Mamlo.
Madam Chair, Representative Dean, I think one of the other things I think is important to make a point about, too, is that the underlying data with which is being used in the modeling is non-public data. So we can't share that. So the information that the carriers submitted, for example, all of the summary information that they submitted on enrollment and all of their products and the risk mix and all of that that is incorporated into the model, the data from the survey on an individual level, that's non-public data. I think if you wanted to make the request to the carriers as to whether or not they would be willing to share that, I think that would be up to them, whether they're willing to share kind of that what they consider trade secret information. But that more detailed information that was used as data in the model is not information that we can share.
And we have two more questions here, Representative Mack and Representative Halverson. Both have question. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I wanted to just touch on something that we kind of started to talk about last night, and that was the rule-setting process inside and outside of the exchange. And I understand a bill is going to be moving forward, and I share the concern and a little bit of confusion as to why those two bills aren't moving side by side. I think it could have made your guys' job a lot easier if that were the case. In regards to that, I'm looking at the fiscal note on page 8 under Section 6, Subdivision 5, and it's talking about market rules inside and outside the marketplace may be different and could potentially result in different premium levels inside versus outside the marketplace. With different market rules inside versus outside the marketplace, there's a risk that premiums inside the marketplace could be higher. And I guess my question is, doesn't this statement that's pretty much spelled out in the fiscal note blow a hole in the message that the marketplace will lower costs? It sounds to me like basically what this is saying and what you said yesterday is that maybe it's setting up the ground level for what that rules legislation is going to look like, but that if the rules are not the same, and if the Department of Commerce or whatever that looks like, or we don't control the rules inside and outside the exchange, it's basically going to make the claim that costs within the marketplace are going to lower. It's going to make that statement inaccurate. Is that correct?
And Representative Mack, just to remind you, and this was stated earlier, we're at the point we are racing through this process because it wasn't done in the last couple of years. So we are on deadline, and it is unfortunate. I would agree with you that we don't have more time to do this together and do it right, but we are facing a deadline on getting this done. And so Ms. Malnoff may have more to say, but.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that statement that is in there is essentially to reflect that, you know, if you do have different rules inside versus outside the exchange, you may have some products outside the exchange that, for example, on network adequacy could be less expensive than those that are in the exchange. The reason why that comment is in there is because some of the research that we consulted when developing the fiscal note was looking at some of the best research that's out there. Some of the best research that is out there and some of the best comments on that actually come from the National Association of Insurance Commissioners. One of the key issues that they have raised and they have recommended that states do is ensure that there's a level playing field inside and outside the exchange so that all the rules are the same, so that there isn't an incentive for the really young and healthy and the cheaper individuals to go outside the exchange because there may be less expensive plans that are out there, and you really get a higher risk of individuals inside the exchange. And so one of the key recommendations, the top one on their list, is making sure that those rules are the same inside and outside the exchange. And that's one of the things that we consulted. In terms of the market rules bill, given that that's not part of the language that's here, I think if you have other questions about that, I would either defer to the Department of Health or the Department of Commerce if they wish to comment on that.
Just a follow-up question to something
sure,
that was said.
Matt.
Could you explain to me? I don't know. What does network adequacy mean? What could you explain that term to me?
I could also ask the health department to answer that question, given that this is more in their bailiwick.
Welcome to the committee. You've been here for several months, I think.
Madam Chair, Manny Munson-Regala, assistant to the commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Health.
Thank you. If you can answer the question.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, network adequacy refers to the concept that when you make a difference in how you treat enrollees based on what doctor you see, there should probably be state oversight in that arrangement. So what would be an example? HMOs used to have a construct where unless you were in network, you got no care at all. That usually meant that the cost of the HMO was cheaper. What the state decided back in 1973, I think, when they passed the HMO Act, is they required the Department of Health to assess the networks of those HMOs to ensure that patients or enrollees had access to doctors and that the care provided was quality. As the business model for plans has evolved, where now the difference is not so much that will you get a claim paid or not, but the difference in payment. Network adequacy has evolved to look at, in those differential payments, how do we still ensure the fundamental goal of ensuring that Minnesotans have access to doctors and that the care provided is quality.
Okay. Any other questions?
Yeah, I think I understood that. I might have to follow up with you as I process that.
Representative Mack.
But I guess just in line with that and in response then to Ms. Mamalov's statement earlier, I guess the concern is that we're setting ourselves up for an inevitable outcome that we're going to have to control the market both in and outside the exchange. If this is a real concern and we want to live up to our word that costs will go down within the exchange, it seems to me that we're the only option we're going to have in order to make that statement correct is an overall control of the plan, which obviously makes the role of the exchange. The only option we're going to have in order to make that statement correct is an overall control of the plan, which obviously makes the role of the exchange board much more powerful than it currently is in terms of they'll be setting rules that impact both the exchange and those outside of the exchange. And I guess my concern with that then, beyond the obvious, is that, if that if that weren't to be the case, if we were to go the other way and not have equal rules and therefore there's not a huge attraction to go inside of the exchange, what is the plan? And I'm wondering if there is a specific plan if the exchange does not attract the minimum amount of people, and I think the number was 200,000, but the necessary number of people in order to adequately fund it. Is there a backup plan that's outlined or put in place? And I would assume there is, but I guess I'm looking for an answer there.
And Ms. Malmov, I'm not sure if you're the appropriate person to respond.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, so I think there's two questions in there. One thing I just wanted to clarify is under the bill as it's written now, it does say that if there are uniform rules that are established that that satisfy the federal law, that they would be determined by Commerce and Health and not by the Exchange Board. So I just wanted to clarify that they would be established and enforced by the Departments of Commerce and Health. On to the question that you had around what is the impact of that, the reason why we wanted to put this in the fiscal note was to make people aware that there would be an impact there. And I think on the specific detail of that, Ms. Julek can probably answer some of the detail around that, but essentially what it would result in is more of a cost allocation to the medical assistance program and a need for a higher level on the withhold, not up to the 3.5%, but higher than what would be projected in each of the high, medium, and low enrollment scenarios. So we did want to acknowledge that risk there and what that would mean on the funding.
And I'd like to just switch to the other side, and I can go back to you if you have more questions.
Yep.
Okay. Representative Halverson.
Thank you.
You've been very quiet.
Madam Chair. I actually wanted to follow up and get a little more information on the comment regarding administrative costs of Minnesota health plans. You said they're about less than 10%. I think we recognize we'd love to see our health care dollars going to health care as much as possible. How does Minnesota compare to other states? Are you able to respond to that or another?
Ms. Malmov.
Somebody?
Madam Chair and Representative, I don't have those numbers in front of me. That actually may be a better question, I think, for the Department of Commerce. There is information that is tracked through the NEIC around some of those administrative components. So we can bring that question back.
Thank you.
Representative Halverson.
Thank you. I appreciate that. One more question, if I
sure.
may, Madam Chair.
Continue.
And this, again, might be a question for somebody else in the audience. I actually thought of this when Mr. Bartsch was testifying, but giving credit where credit is due, I understand that previous legislators have put into law that our health HMOs have to be nonprofit in Minnesota. And so thinking about that, I would be interested in any idea of what average margins might be currently for health plans in Minnesota. Because we did have that very good question about what profits are in our state. So,
Ms. Mamla.
Again, Madam Chair, Representative, we can follow up with
okay.
the Commerce Department on that question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Back to Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Appreciate it. I guess just on a follow-up, and I don't think I heard an answer, but if you did, if you could just reiterate it. What did you say, or what is the plan if the exchange doesn't hit the numbers? That it needs in order to adequately fund? What's the backup plan in place? And if there is one, is that something we'd be able to see in the near future?
Ms. Malmov.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack. So as I mentioned, we figure the impact could be upwards of 202,000 that's in there. That would cost allocate more onto the medical assistance program. It would also increase what the withhold would need to be, but it would not go above 3.5% of premium. So there's that. The other component piece that is included in the legislation is the 3.5% that would be collected in 2014 that establishes that operational reserve. Part of the reason for that operational reserve is to account for any fluctuations that are there in enrollment to account for that in those early years.
Okay, Madam Chair. I guess you kind of answered my follow-up question then, because that was going to be my next question, is I noticed that in the fiscal note it shows that, and do we start collecting that withhold? Does that start January 1st of 2014? And I understand that the feds will be paying the full operational cost of the exchange in 2014. So if I heard you correct, the state will still be collecting the withhold, even though the feds are kicking in all the money to run the exchange that year. and we're collecting that money for what purpose in 2014, even though the feds will be kicking in all the money anyway?
Ms. Mama.
Madam Chair, Representative Mack, there's two reasons for the need for that those funds in to be started on January 1st of 2014. The first one is around the operational reserve for fluctuations in enrollment. That is one. The other is purely a cash flow issue. So the exchange is likely to, in 2015, for example, have much of its expenditures on IT and some of the other customer service components that happen at the early part of a year. And under the withhold, you're collecting roughly the same amount each month. And so if you have more expenses that you have to pay in the first part of the year, but the revenue is split throughout the year, you may not be able to pay your bills in the first half of that year. And so the second reason is for to deal with cash flow issues.
And I'd like to interject a question in here, and it's kind of based on something I saw in the Department of Labor and Industry. You're making assumptions about the need. Can you tell me, are you ramping up the staffing? Is it accounting for the ramping up, as you just talked about, it may be a slow uptake because you don't actually know, or have you put all the costs that could possibly be there on the front end, even though you may not need all those staff right away, or it may not be realized? And we saw this in the Department of Labor and Industry a number of years ago, where they made an assumption about an uptake of a particular program. They hired 10 staff thinking the program would happen, and it didn't happen anywhere near the way they thought it was, and they had 8 or 10 staff. They were trying to find other things to do. And I guess I'm just looking for your assumptions and the reality and how this is going to play out, if you've accounted for that somehow.
Madam Chair, we have in the budget, as you'll see in the fiscal note, there are a variety of areas that the spending is quite a bit lower in the initial years than in the later years. And the key area around that is in customer service. Customer service is an area where there a large share of our budget is there, and we want to make sure that people are able to be served. And so as that need goes up, there is the customer service side of that does go up. And so to your point, yes, that is reflected in the fiscal note, and we wanted to make sure that we were looking at both the high, medium, and low scenarios and in 14 and 15 and adjusting that for what enrollment may occur.
Thank you. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so I guess just to wrap up on the point of collecting the withhold in 2014, you know, we hear a lot that the exchange isn't going to necessarily cost Minnesotans anything, or at least at first that we get all this drawdown money from the federal government. But I guess what I'm seeing in actuality is that we're still going to be applying a tax to Minnesotans in 2014. When yes, the federal government dollars that we've been talking about are going to be there, but we're still going to be setting up this operational reserve for if our numbers are wrong. And in addition to that, you know, we hear that we think 2.25% withhold is going to be enough. But again, it sounds to me like they're, in the absence of a backup plan or a systematic backup plan, we'll just have to ratchet up that withhold to 3.5%, which eliminates a lot of the savings that Representative Atkins has referenced. And so I guess that's just a concern that, you know, the backup plan is to tax Minnesotans when we don't necessarily need to. The federal government's giving us dollars to fund this. And so I guess I just see some holes in some of the statements that have been made, some of the claims as to the benefits of this program, when Minnesotans are going to see an increased burden for covering what could be inaccurate numbers or things not going the way that we hope they do in the first couple of years of the exchange.
Ms. Momov, can you address that? And it's my understanding, well, first off, if we don't do the Minnesota Exchange, according to the ACA, which is the law, we're going to have a federal exchange imposed on us, and I assume that will have some sort of fee and structure as well, so it has to be paid for. And if we don't use the fee, the percent that we're talking about, there are other venues, but we're still going to pay for it. It isn't free no matter how we do this. So can you explain, are there other options that we could have chosen, and why did we choose this? And if we don't do this, we're going to pay for it through the federal program anyway, as I understand it.
Madam Chair, to both your question and Representative Mack's mm-hmm. question, under the federal exchange, they will be collecting at least a 3.5% premium withhold, and they do start that on January 1st of 2014 as well. in the same way. What I would say to Representative Mack's question is it does establish a reserve, prudent business practices to make sure that you do have a reserve there. If that reserve is not needed into the future, then there would be the ability to reduce the premium withhold even more than some of the levels, I think, within the fiscal note are down at 1.75%. It could go even much lower than that.
Thank you. Members, are there any other questions that we have?
I have one last.
Representative Mack has another question.
Thank you. And just one final question. I guess just to try to get as clear of an answer if possible on this, and then I have one question for the author if he's still here, and if not, it can wait till Monday.
It was just a moment ago. We can out of the hall. If
but so I guess just more or less for a yes or no, if the numbers fail, will the withhold be bumped up to 3.5%? Is that pretty much the option we have if the numbers fail in the first few years of the exchange and beyond?
Ms. Momolov.
Madam Chair, if enrollment is lower for a variety of reasons, then there's the ability for the board to establish the withhold up to 3.5%. We don't think that it will need to be that high, even if the enrollment projections are a little different.
Okay. Thank you. And I think they're bringing Representative Atkins in.
Okay.
And there he is. Representative Atkins, we have a question for you.
Okay.
Representative Matt.
My daughter's got a half day of school today, so we're trying to figure out. She's apparently going to have lunch at Panda. Just an FYI for the members of the committee who are getting hungry like I am.
Thank you. Representative Matt.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Representative Atkins. I think it's a brief question, and then I am done, and thanks for everyone's patience. I guess I was not here yesterday morning for all of the testimony, but I did listen after the fact, and one thing we talked about a little bit in Health and Human Services policy that I guess I'm just kind of looking to get nailed down is I continue to hear testifiers talk about the ability of the exchange to negotiate, and I think there's some confusion, and I hear from some constituents that are under the assumption that the exchange will be there to negotiate a better product for them, better prices, things like that. And so I guess I'm just looking for, maybe with the help of Commerce, clarification on if you could just walk me through what the exchange will have the ability to negotiate once a plan comes to them wanting to get into the exchange.
Representative Atkins.
Yeah. Madam Chair and Representative Mack, I actually appreciate you bringing that topic up because I think I started that problem by using the term negotiate, and I don't think that's exactly what we're, well, I don't think it's at all what we're talking about. What I'm hoping for is that, and what I expect is that we would end up with the best products available for consumers. But I don't expect at all for there to be a negotiation over price. I say that flat without any adjectives. There will not be a negotiation over price. But by virtue of the fact that whenever you have folks that apply, this might be a better analogy. You have a bunch of people that apply for a position, and maybe there's only a handful of positions that are available. By virtue of the fact that you can select from the ones that apply, you can take the very best ones. Maybe that's a little better analogy. And so you got this sort of competition that will occur among those trying to offer their products. I believe that's a little better analogy for what the select language would provide for.
Okay. So, Madam Chair, just to clarify, we're not talking about a situation where the exchange could barter necessarily and say to one plan, well, you know, they're offering this. If you could, it's not necessarily that. It's the exchange says we're, and maybe if I even hear you right, the exchange would say we're going to let this number of plans in. So, in a sense, good luck plans. Here are the slots of how many of you can fit into. We're going to pick your number, 5, 10, 25, whatever it might be. And then, you know, plans do the very best they can to put a product together, hoping they get one of the 25 slots or whatever the exchange, the number that the exchange decides is going to be allowed in the exchange. Am I hearing you correct on that?
Representative Atkins.
And Madam Chair, Representative Mack, that's one possible fashion that it might, or you may also see that there's a desire for a meaningful difference between those plans that are offered. Actually, I wish Representative Abler, he was the first one that brought me, and I'm sure you got the term down. But he walked me through about a month ago some of the things that I might want to know. And that was one, you know, you've got several that are really close to each other. Makes it difficult to discern which one's which and all of that. So it might be that you ask of them that they put together some offerings that provide a meaningful difference for consumers. Again, with the idea of narrowing a little bit and giving a little bit more competition to whoever is going to be selected to participate.
And thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Adkins. I don't mean to belabor that point, but it is something I keep hearing testifiers reference, and I just think there's some confusion, and better to be fair that testifiers understand what the true role of the exchange is supposed to be. So thank you for that.
You bet.
Thank you. I think that wraps up our questions for today. I want to remind everyone that we have until 2 p.m. to file those amendments. So if you have thoughts or ideas that you need to get on the table for further discussion and consideration, 2 p.m. today. And then we are going to come back at 9 a.m. on Monday. We'll reconvene this committee and we'll start taking up amendments. And I look forward to that discussion. Representative Atkins, thank you for hanging out today. And I hope you can grab your daughter for lunch.
Thank you, Madam Chair. That's the plan.
So with that, the meeting is adjourned.